All right. Let's come to order. Let's come to order. Members, we have a quorum. Good morning. Today, Wednesday, January 15th, 2020, and the time is 9:14 a.m. Now I call this meeting of Dallas City Council to order. We'll begin with an invocation, followed by our pledges of allegiance. Chair recognizes our Deputy Mayor, Adam Magoo, to introduce our guest who's here to give today's invocation. Please rise.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. It is a distinct honor to welcome the pastor of New Mount Zion Church in the heart of Hamilton Park in District 10, Pastor Tommy Brown. He's the fifth pastor of New Mount Zion, been there since 2014. Dr. Brown is a graduate of Andersonville Theological Seminary, where he received his doctorate of theology. Dr. Brown's passion is preaching and teaching. He's a gifted man of God who loves ministering to families and is always quick to step up to meet the needs of our community. He's a respected leader not only locally but also on the national level, where he serves as the second vice president of the Dallas Baptist Ministers Union, the third vice moderator of the Greater Rising Star District Association, and general secretary of the National Missionary Baptist Convention of America. Dr. Brown is married to his high school sweetheart, First Lady Ruth Chanel Morris, who, by the way, they just celebrated their 37th anniversary this past weekend. He has two daughters, Veronica and Angela, and one son, Joshua. He's a faithful leader. He steps up each and every time our community needs it. During the recent storms, they stepped up and provided food for the community, service for the community, and helped cleaning up our areas after the tornadoes. Always leading our kids, our youth, in amazing ways. I invite every one of you to New Mount Zion on any Sunday coming up, because you'll get the best worship, the best time, man of God. And I really appreciate him being here this morning. He's got a full day. He's already discussed his leadership and work today, but he's here this morning to open our meeting. Thank you, Pastor Brown.
Thank you, Counselor. Let us bow. God, we thank you for all your blessings upon the city of Dallas. We thank you for the freedom, health, and safety that you have bestowed upon us. And I ask you today to guide our council and grant them wisdom and knowledge and enable them to conduct the affairs of our city. As they carry out the responsibility entrusted to them by the citizens of Dallas, I ask that you would enfold them with your love, enfold them with the assurance of your constant presence with them. God, we thank you today because you have given mankind a strong desire to do good, to serve others, and to faithfully fulfill their obligations to their neighbors. I pray for this assembled council, and I'm asking that you would graciously grant this council wisdom to govern amid the many interests and issues of our times. Grant them a sense of the welfare and true needs of our people. Grant them a keen thirst for justice and righteousness. Grant them the confidence in what is good and is fitting in your eyes. Grant them the ability to work together in harmony, even when there is honest disagreement. Grant them personal peace in their lives and good health as they share joy in their task. And I pray for the agenda set before them today. Please give an assurance of what would please you and would benefit those who live and work in and around our beloved city of Dallas. It is in your most blessed name I pray. Amen.
Amen. Remain standing. Chair recognizes Councilmember Basil Dewey to lead us in our pledges of allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Honor the Texas flag. I pledge allegiance to thee, Texas, one state, under God, one and indivisible.
You may be seated. We have a few special presentations this morning. Chair recognizes Chairwoman Arnold.
This morning we have a number of presentations that we're going to present, and we're going to move as expeditiously as possible. Many of you will remember that we were delayed in these recognitions due to our schedules in November and December, so I will proceed to the podium at this time. Thank you, Mayor, to the mayor, to the council, to the audience. It is always an honor that we have an opportunity to recognize our constituents. And it's just good for us to reach out to, of course, to support the stakeholders who support us. And so it is with that I move this morning to recognize the following. Noah Cathy, age 13. Megan Manning, age 14. Micah and Matthew Munchrat. Miss Barbara Reckitt of Reckitt's Barbecue. And Chief Albert Martinez. We brag a lot about doing more in District 4, but this is what we're presenting today speaks volumes not only of 4, but also of the city. So I would ask, first of all, Noah Cathy and Megan Manning to come up in center stage. Come on up. We're going to do this a little bit differently. You know, my background is education, so we have to be flexible. These individuals were awarded in the fall, Mr. and Mrs. National Congeniality at a pageant in which they had to compete at Harding University based on speech and delivery. With their performance, they have received a $64,000 scholarship to Oklahoma Christian University upon high school graduation. And so it's an honor that we have them. Noah and Megan are here with their parents. Mr. and Mr. Cathy, would you step up also with your loved ones here? Come on up. Also, where's Megan's grandmother? She's here. Come on up. We want you to come on up to the center. So we're very proud of you. We want to continue to invest in our youth, and we always want to showcase them because we intend to pass the baton off to you individuals to continue to lead this city. So we appreciate this morning you coming up with us. Ms. Williams here also with Megan. Also coming up forward, Micah and Matthew Munchrat. Are you here this morning? All right, they may be coming later. Part of this family I taught at Bishop Dunn. This is the family that has given us some healthy eating habits. They own Ann's Health Food Center and Market. Their flagship store is located on Zhang Boulevard, and their latest store is in Waxahachie on Highway 77. They're now also, I know that Mr. Casey Thomas' chest is getting big because they're coming to District 3. And I was happy about that. But it is just an honor to have a family that has been committed to the southern sector for over 35 years, and it speaks volumes of their seriousness and commitment to the community. So I want to thank them. Last but not least, let's move to Reckitt's Barbecue. Yeah, come on up. Where's Ms. Reckitt? Come on up, Ms. Reckitt. Ms. Reckitt and her husband founded Reckitt's Barbecue almost 50 years ago. And they have been in the southern sector in this location on Lancaster location, for over 50 years. And as part of their celebration, they have begun a scholarship in the honor of Mr. Reckitt. And it speaks volumes of their commitment even to Noah and to Megan and their generation to come, so as leaders. So we want to thank them so very much. You know, Ms. Reckitt, you fed a number of us here in this room and a number of police officers as well through the years. But she continues to advocate for quality of life so that we can pass the baton, and we appreciate that so much. So without further ado, the last person that we want to recognize, and Vernicia, I want to also throw a shout out to Miss Vernicia Cathy because she also is related to this family. That's the aunt. So I wanted to put that out there. Last but not least, what happened to my pump? Pump up the volume. The last person, is he here, Chief Albert Martinez? All right. Chief Albert Martinez is a little shy, but we are so proud of Chief Albert Martinez for his work in South Central and Southwest. Most of you know that he'll be leaving us in a couple of weeks, I believe, to go to the diocese. And we just could not let him leave without thanking him for his over 27 years in law enforcement. And just the fact that he has a bond with our community, and that's what we're pushing more for in District 4. And so I know that you're going to leave your work behind with Major Younger and Weddington and others, but we're going to miss you truly. And I know you said you're going to come back, and that's what folks normally say, I'm going to always be with you, but we appreciate so very much. So let's give him a round of applause, if you will. Mayor, would you stand up so we're going to do something differently today. The mayor's going to take one quick picture with us. See, that'll cut down some of this folks on. Do I have to get up there? Do I have to get up there? Yeah, you're going to come up, counsel, if you want to. But I think we really want to get the children, especially with our mayor. So let's take a quick pic. Let's get the plaque. Yeah.
Record
Chair, we have one more special recognition before I go on to that. I want to recognize Chairman Narvaez.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. To all the people that were honored today, congratulations, and thank you for all your hard work. And to Chief Martinez, thank you from the bottom of our heart out of West Dallas portion of District 6. You have done an amazing job, and we as well are going to miss you very, very much. And to Noah, I know he's running out the door, but Noah Cathy, a lot of people may or may not know this, but I get to go to the Mavs games every once in a while, and I have a good time. And he works down on the court and part-time and does a really good job making sure our Dallas Mavericks stay safe by helping keep the floor clean and working really hard out there. So on top of everything else he's doing, he's also a Mavs fan for life, and we really appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
You are welcome. I see a couple of members want to say something, but is this on the special presentation? Okay.
Yeah.
Chairman Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I also want to say congratulations, Chief. You know how I feel about you, and so we thank you for what you've done for the city. It's always an honor to be able to it's always a pleasure to be able to honor young people and recognize them. I wish I would have had $500 in scholarships going to college, but to have the $60,000, that's awesome. That's phenomenal. And so I want to commend them and keep up the good work. And then to the ladies of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, happy Founders Day.
Chairman Atkins.
Yes, okay. Thank you also, Councilman Arnold, for your presentation. A great deal. But also, I'm going to get a shout out to the AKA Founder Day. But also, I want to thank Chief Martinez. I mean, we're going to miss you, but we know he's still going to be in the city of Dallas and protecting all the people in the city. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much. All right. One more special recognition. I want to read to honor a West Dallas resident who has served her community and the city of Dallas for nearly 20 years, Geraldine McDaniel. So it's going to read a portion of this resolution. It says, whereas Geraldine McDaniel began serving her community as senior affairs commissioner when she was appointed on September 11, 2002, by Elba Garcia. She served five terms on the Senior Affairs Commission, including one term appointed by Councilmember Omar Narvaez, and two terms on the Martin Luther King Community Center Board. And whereas Geraldine McDaniel has been a longtime member of the Ledbetter Gardens Neighborhood Crime Watch, Senior Bible Study Group at Voice of Hope, and Peniel's Seventh-day Adventist Church, it is through these organizations that she worked to advocate on behalf of the community, paying special interest to the affairs of senior adults on the local and state levels. And whereas the City of Dallas commends Geraldine McDaniel for her dedication to positively impacting lives in West Dallas, now, therefore, I, Eric Johnson, Mayor of the City of Dallas, and on behalf of the entire Dallas City Council, on January 15, 2020, do hereby extend special recognition to Geraldine McDaniel for her service to the City of Dallas. So let's commend Ms. McDaniel for many years of service. If you wouldn't mind, Ms. Arnold.
Thank you. Forgive me, Council and audience. You know, I would be remiss if I did not call out Ms. Ruth Wyrick, who is the grandmother of Noah, and all of us around here know who Ms. Ruth Wyrick is. So she has produced great fruit, but thank you for your work, and thank you for what you continue to do for this city, and we must take a picture with you as well. Thank you.
Ms. McDaniel, would you mind coming up to the podium so I can present you with this recognition, and we can take a photograph with you, and Chairman. Would you like to come up and would you like to say a few words?
Yes, yes, please, Mr. Mayor. For those at the council, if you don't know Ms. McDaniel, I just recently learned her actual first name. I thought her first name was Ms. So all these years that I've known her. But some of the things that people don't know about Ms. McDaniel is that she's the one that was responsible back in the day for actually getting DART services into West Dallas when there was no DART services. So she's actually a VIP member of DART. There's only a few of these passes ever given out, and it's actually signed by the CEO of DART, and she has one of those passes as well. I know Dr. Elba Garcia's office is here as well, our county commissioner, and they have a recognition that they'll be presenting to her as well, Mr. Mayor. And then I just want to thank Ms. McDaniel for all of her hard work, her tireless work. Recently, something happened to her where a truck backed into her home that was doing some construction nearby, and her home had to be demolished. And now she's getting a new house, so that's a fantastic thing. But because of that and everything that was going on, she decided that it was time for her to retire from her service here at City Hall. And it's a good thing, because we talked about it, and I remember telling her, Ms. McDaniel, you've taken care of us for so many, 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 many years that it's our turn to give back to you and take care of you. And I really appreciate Mayor Johnson for recognizing this formidable woman and this pillar of the community of West Dallas. And on behalf of District 6, Ms. McDaniel, and all of us in West Dallas, we love you and we congratulate you. Now, we're not going to let you just stop working and volunteering with us. We're going to keep you around and keep doing it, but on your own time from now on. But we also have an award that we want to present to her as well, and some flowers. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Chairman Narvaez. I'm going to take a picture, and then members who want to come up here, if you wouldn't mind coming up so we can get one more photograph.
Behalf of us in District 6, we're going to present you with this City of Dallas Award on behalf of the district. Yeah, I'll hold this one. Let's switch over this one.
So anyway,
Council, we're going to bring you over here to the
last photo.
Thank you.
Okay, that's all our special recognitions for the morning. I just have a few announcements. I want to take a moment to remind everyone that this Monday is Martin Luther King Day. The city of Dallas is hosting a series of events to celebrate Dr. King's legacy, and I hope everyone will join us for the annual parade on Monday and the other events that are happening throughout the weekend. More information about these events are available on our city's website. I also want to say thank you to all the volunteers and all the city staff for the hours that they put into making all these events possible. We are now going to turn to our open microphone speakers. Madam City Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Good morning. We did have one cancellation. Therefore, your first five registered speakers will be Robert Ceccarelli, Irvy Foster, Reggie Ruffin, Mallory York, and Curtis Jones. I'll recite the speaker guidelines. Speakers must observe the same rules of propriety, decorum, and good conduct applicable to members of the City Council. Any speaker making personal, impertinent, profane, or slanderous remarks, or who becomes boisterous while addressing the City Council shall be removed from the room. Individuals are given 3 minutes to speak. You'll notice the time at the monitor in front of you. When your time is up, please stop. Address your comments to Mayor Johnson only. Also, if you have any handouts, you may go ahead and hand it to the officer to my right, as it will affect your speaking time. Your first speaker is Robert Ceccarelli.
Good morning, everybody. Before I get to my title, I'm making a plea to the mayor and city council. There was a person named Henry Chambers at the West End, 75 years old. I'm speaking today because I'm afraid he might die at the West End of natural causes of being homeless. This has been going on for years. The dark police know about it. He hangs out there all the time. He sleeps on the chairs at the West End. And it would be a tragedy if this person died at the West End on the streets. I don't think the city would be able to ever overcome this. It's well known about this person. I'm asking the mayor to please get involved in this personally, because there's a perception about you, like I said before, that you don't care about the less fortunate, sir, and the homeless. This would be a good for the citizens of the city to change their minds about you. That's why I'm asking it, because he's a very nice person. Ms. Gates would be a perfect person for the St. Jude in your district. I'm just asking you, and like I said, if he does die, it would be something that the city will never overcome. Please do it today. That's why I had to bring this up. I have to about the mayor. I've been going to all these meetings, homeless meetings, for years. I've come to the conclusion that the only way this is going to happen is the head of the leadership, the mayor, gets involved. Like I said before, Mayor Rollins was a sellout at the Omni. If you ever get that tape, you would see why I say that. I'm just convinced that, man, this isn't going nowhere. What you did with DPD, I applaud you for it, but it seems like you pick and choose what you want to do. You're here for everybody, Mayor, and this is the time now, because all I can say now is since Homeless Solutions has been here, it's only been 50 miles at the bridge. Mayor, I'm just saying to you, serve everybody, and I'm asking you, I've said this before about you, please get involved. What you did with DPD, do it with the homeless. Get cracked down on it. There's nothing going on. About the inclement weather, they've been talking about this for 7 years, and they're still talking about it. What gets me is it's not that important. It's not that many days where it's going to be inclement weather. So I told the commission yesterday to scratch it and start talking about that bond money and about the bond money. I really have to blame the city council for that 2%. Before you became the mayor, before the crime crisis, the leading problem was the homelessness. And there was only 2% of that bond money, and that was because the city council didn't care about the homeless, the previous city council. That's a tragedy right there. And I'm just saying, Mayor, it's up to you. I've been doing it for 7 years. It's up to you to get involved, at least sit in the meetings, and do what you did yesterday with Renee Hall. Get involved right now, or you can have more deaths of senior citizens in the West End, but please get involved with Henry Chambers. That would be the first way to start this, sir, so the citizens will have a different heart about you. Thank you.
Irvy Foster.
Honorable City Councilors, Mayor Johnson, Mr. Broadnax, the stock market is at an all-time high. The unemployment for all races is at a 50-year low, and wages are actually ticking up. The city of Dallas, with our affluence, wealth, and record growth, should be a beacon to the nation, but we're not. Murder is at its highest rate in over 10 years. Because of crime, Dallas is becoming a truly unpleasant choice as a place to live. Businesses in the southern sector have continued to flee, and now we hear how 15-year-olds think it's okay to shoot up basketball games. We need to look deeper than new crime-fighting plans. We need to look at our own values, priorities, and faith, and how it is affecting your official decisions and this internal culture. Over the last several years, city officials have instituted very unbiblical policies. In DPD, the 21st century policing model, for one. Next, you hired an unseasoned police chief. And then you sat quietly while the county decriminalized small crimes like theft and dismissed thousands of misdemeanor cases. These cases would have been red flags that would have helped our justice system identify family breakdowns and potential violence before it turns into violence. How do I know this? It's a biblical principle. Luke 16:10 says, "He who is up to no good in little is up to no good in much." But our police will never know because we've decriminalized it. It is ungodly to allow thefts under $750 to go unaccountable for because someone is hungry. Proverbs 6:30, "Do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his hunger." But the part we forget to continue to read is, "If he is caught, he must restore sevenfold." It is time for city councilors and city employees and faith leaders who are members of the body of Christ to repent, put two legs under your faith, and begin to speak up within this city. Your job and your position as counselor does not exempt you from your faith and speaking about unbiblical practices. Psalm 118 says it's better to trust the Lord for protection than to trust anyone else, including strong leaders. Too many innocent children have died and continue to die to trust this city to an unseasoned police chief only because we refuse to walk in our faith and accept our responsibilities. God isn't interested in more plans, but repentant hearts. His promise, he does have a promise for you. If my people who are called by my name will turn from their sin and repent and pray, I will hear from heaven and I will heal your land. 2 Chronicles 7:14. I know others are pulling the trigger, but God is asking you to humble yourself and pray. Thank you. Mr. Mayor, can I put this in the record?
Just hand it to
yes, thank you.
Sonia Blue has canceled. Reggie Ruffin.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Reggie Ruffin, 2703 Exeter Avenue. I represent the Just Cause Coalition. We have talked about these issues over and over again, and it seems like it's not been taken seriously enough. I left all of you some mail for y'all to ponder the fact that, as a whole, the city council has been elected to provide legal leadership for the city. But unfortunately, until we get to the point that we treat all of Dallas as a whole instead of parceling off as some, we'll never get any progress. I heard about the proposal for the crime bill and everything like that, but here's my thing about it. We have over 500,000 911 calls that come in, and you barely have 3,500 cops. Now, Chicago is a city close to the size of Dallas, have 10,000 police officers. So we are seriously understaffed, undermanned, and undermined. But one of the other problems we also have is the fact that when police do get involved, they kind of pick and choose on how they want to proceed with handling cases depending on what side of town we live on. That by itself is also a violation of people's rights. We have to want to do things the right way. We have to start having empathy as opposed to apathy. So I am asking, it's incumbent upon the city council to start taking these matters seriously. And when the police are starting to get to the point we cannot trust them, we have to get new police and start training them to do things in the right way as opposed to what their bailiwick tells them to do. Because everyone is taking an oath. They said they're supposed to take it seriously, supposed to defend and protect the citizens no matter what the consequences are. So we don't need to have any more political celebrities. We need political advocates that want to stand up and fight for the people who they say they're out here to uphold their rights. So on that note, we'll be talking again and I will be reminding you of what needs to be done. Thank you.
Mallory York.
Good morning, Council. My name is Mallory York, Jr. Today I'll be talking about heart health and basically in the African-American community. I got up this morning and I usually run in the morning for my mind and for my health. You know, I watched or heard or even seen, you know, five of my clients or my clients' families and friends, grandfathers died from heart disease. All of them was actually African-American. So when I seen that, that was kind of alarming to me because, you know, I don't want to see, you know, people dying like that at mid-50s and early 60s. That's too early, you know. So, like I said, I got up this morning, and actually I was running around this building. That's a good run, you know. It's about almost a mile around, seemed like to me. Take me about 6 minutes to get around it. But I think, I thought it would take longer than that, but I looked at the clock. I said, well, that's only been 6 minutes. I mean, I've been running around this thing a long time if I'm only getting 6 minutes, or I ran around so many times. Now, also, that comes, that's good. I use it for, you know, for my mental, but it's also good for my health. So I use just a two-piece combination. But it also helps with mental health. And when this gentleman over here talks about the homeless people out here, you know, I own a small barbershop right now here on Lamar Street. And I see these guys walking past all day. Actually, this morning I seen a lot of them, you know, just walking to 7-Eleven. But every now and then you see them tripping out, you know. They having problems, you know. They actually have mental, you know, a lot of them have mental illnesses, you know. And they try to medicate themselves with, you know, with illegal drugs or whatever, you know, whatever they can get their hands on. But constantly you're seeing this type of stuff. So Parkland used to have, jumping back to heart health, Parkland had a program that they used to come to the barbershops and give the guys a, you know, they'll do a heart check on these guys, you know, so they can get kind of like, you know, an early warning so they can, you know, get to a doctor, get themselves checked out. You know, I encourage you guys to, you know, to start exercise a little bit more, you know. Because we need you guys here. We can't have our grandfathers dying because that's a lot. You know, they got resources. They're dropping the kids off. They do actually a lot of work. Lastly, I want to talk about is the family court. I believe, you know, the family court down here, do you have to keep paying attention to them? You know, the family is important. That's one of my main things. And I believe the family court puts a lot of stress on our community. They need to do better there, you know, and they need to assess these guys' income before they start taking their money. That's all I ask them is assess the income before they take their money. Also, I'd like to ask still for, can I have an extension?
No. Thank you.
Okay. Last time it took a minute from me, but that's okay.
Thank you.
Curtis Jones.
Good morning, counselors. I'd like to speak on the southern sector here. We're in Dallas. We have a very low apartment rate for the Southern District. In 2005, the city of Dallas, Councilman Tunnell Atkins, District 8, widened the street, Houston School Road, to make more access to the new college that was coming out. But we also needed housing for the low income. I have 10 acres that I wanted the city to help develop for the low income there because of the 20,000, 2000, when they bought the new quarter in off 20 for the modular systems coming out of the Panama Canal, it brought a lot of industry with and a lot of development through 20, but the housings to support those developments are short. And I'd like for Mr. Atkins and the City of Councils to get with me to help me to help provide more low-income housing for that area. I know that there are millions of dollars that the city has with tax credits, just like they're doing the new Omni off the old Redbird Center Mall. I'd like for the city to actually help and show that you're willing to help provide low-income housing for people. It could also have a portion for the handicapped, disabled veterans, just as I am, and for the homeless. And so I know there are corporations that they say that if they're really interested in doing something to make Dallas a more pleasurable place for to show that they have compassion for the low income, the people that doesn't have the degrees. But the city of Dallas can't be a more friendly person to help with housing. I grew up in West Dallas projects. I'm 71 years old. I've lived here. I've seen so many illegal things that has gone on through the Dallas. But it can be better. And you, Mayor, I spoke when Mayor Rollins was here, when they had a thing about the homeless. Deep Ellum was really complaining about the homeless. They were speaking on purchasing Avalon for $20 million. You can buy my property and build a facility just as the city would like. And Mr. Atkins, I left word with you that I wanted to get with you to talk about this, and this will help the city, and I thank you. And I just ask you, Mayor, to take portions in doing this. Thank you very much.
Councilman Thomas.
Mr. Jones.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for coming down and sharing those concerns.
Who?
Right here.
Oh,
right
I'm
here.
Sorry.
Just want to tell you, I hope you plan to stay around because we're going to be getting briefed on neighborhood empowerment zones, and that's something that's going to really help in order to create more opportunities through our housing policy of what you're talking about. So hopefully you'll stick around for the briefing, and you'll hear the council discussion.
A few more hours?
Yeah, should be no more than maybe a couple hours.
All right, I'll do that, sir. Thank you.
Thanks, ma'am.
Thank you. This concludes your first five registered speakers. We'll now move to your voting agenda. Agenda item one is approval of minutes of the November 19, 2019 City Council meeting.
Is there a motion? Discussion? All in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries.
Item two is consideration of appointments to boards and commissions. This morning, there are two individual appointments for consideration. To the Citizen Homelessness Commission, John Shaleen is being nominated by Deputy Mayor Pro Tem McGew. Mr. Shaleen meets the general public special qualification. To the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center Board, Amanda Rochelle Johnson is being nominated by Councilmember Arnold.
Any discussion? All in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Mayor, your briefings continue.
Okay. We'll turn it over to the city manager.
Thank you, Mayor and Council, and as staff begins to walk up to the microphones. Today, you're going to get an overview on the city's animal care services department's functions, as well as look back at some of their performance over the last year, if not two, as well as particularly related to public safety, and then talk about some historical context to really frame some of the accomplishments that they've made over the last couple of years. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ed Jamison, the director of Dallas Animal Services, and he'll introduce the rest of people at the dais.
Good morning, Mayor, City Council, City Manager. Thank you for having us here. There's a lot of new faces that I've been able to work with, but this is the first time I've been able to formally sit down in front of you, so I really appreciate the opportunity. First slide. We are going to, throughout this presentation, we're going to go through some background of the City of Dallas animal situation, purpose. We have a timeline of the last couple of years of events. Our organizational structure, as long as the principles that have driven decisions over the last couple of years, overview of our field operations, talk about the increased intake, as well as our commitment to saving lives and looking forward. So, next slide. Mr. Brodsky.
Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Mayor and City Council. Thank you for the opportunity to present. My name is Peter Brodsky. I'm the chair of the Animal Services Commission. And I was asked to speak here today because we've got a a team other than Ann Barnes over there that has come in since the BCG report that we presented in 2016. So I'm a little bit of the holder of some of the history and institutional knowledge, and I just wanted to set the context of today's presentation. So last time I had the opportunity to present before you was a couple months after Antoinette Brown was killed by a pack of dogs. We presented a Boston Consulting Group report, and at the time, Dallas Animal Services had been underfunded, and frankly, it was being managed by a team whose strategy was to increase the live release rate, not by increasing positive outcomes, but by picking up fewer dogs and decreasing the denominator. That led to a real crisis of public safety, particularly in southern Dallas, that ultimately was horribly illustrated by Antoinette Brown's death. Thanks to the leadership of City Council and the leadership of the city manager and his team, DAS has since become a well-funded organization, and it's got a first-class management team led by Ed Jameson and managed by Nadia Chandler Hardy. The results speak for themselves. Since the end of fiscal 16, Dallas now picks up annually 50% more dogs than it used to. That's 20,000 to 30,000, 10,000 more dogs a year, which is still a startling number of dogs that need to be picked up. And the amazing thing is that with all that increase in the dog pickups, the live release rate has now grown to 90%, and even though Ed doesn't like this term, that is considered no kill by industry standards. So it shows that you can walk and chew gum at the same time when you're managed and funded appropriately. I do want to note that there's been a lot of talk about dangerous dogs. There have been several public comments before you at council, and I just want to put in perspective that of the 30,000 dogs that were handled by Dallas Animal Services last year, about 70 of them were deemed dangerous. That is 0.2%. And so the dangerous dogs are an issue. We've got a good process, and despite many of the complaints that you've gotten, most of our dangerous dog deemings are verified by court. And I would encourage you, as you hear these stories, although some of them may feel compelling, pardon the pun, but don't let the tail wag the dog on this. The last thing I want to say is that the issue's not over. It took decades to get this way. It's going to take a long time to fix it, despite the progress that we've made. And so I would encourage you to keep up the level of funding. And if you need any evidence that there's still problems, just think about the attack on Maria Robledo that almost resulted in a death earlier this year in Keyst Park. So we're in the right direction, up and to the right. Lots of work to do, but you have a terrific team here that I'm very proud to be associated with. Ed.
Sorry, I forgot to turn it on there. I apologize. Okay, so for the timeline, in fiscal year 16, and I'm not going to read all of the bullet points, but fiscal year 16 really was about diagnosing the problem. That was the year that the Antoinette Brown situation happened. There was already an internal city audit happening at that time, which we included in the appendix, that if you haven't read it, if you get a chance, you should read it, because a lot of what we did was fixing what was identified was broken before, and we are very proud of the things that we fixed in the city audit. The BCG report, which was voted on by council to implement fully, was a part of 2016, and Dallas Police Department actually took over Dallas Animal Services during that period. Fiscal year 17 was really about reform and a huge foundational heavy lift. I can't tip my hat enough to the work that Dallas Police Department did. They came into a very difficult situation and started putting some foundations in. And also included in that was addressing the dangerous dog, some of the dangerous dog things in that audit. Fiscal year 18 is the year that I got here and started building the team. I was very happy that they were recording a lot. We didn't know what a lot of the data meant, but they made a big push because they hadn't recorded many prior. So we try to record everything so that we can make really informed decisions. The animal world, as all of you know, is extremely emotional. It's emotional for my staff. It's emotional for the people that visit the visit the shelter. I'm looking at the people who've adopted from me since you've been here. But it is very emotional. And if you're making these decisions when you're dealing with public safety, solely on emotion, you're going to find situations like we had in 2016. And then in fiscal year 19 was really the strategic heavy lift and where we started looking at results and what's working and really pushing through on the things that were putting out really good results. Budget enhancements have been each of the years that I've been here, which to this body in front of me can't thank enough because it really does take resources to do the work that the team is putting together. And I think for context, it's really important to know that Dallas has the third highest dog and cat intake in the country, only behind Los Angeles City and Los Angeles County. You know, we're not the third highest population, but yet we have the third highest dog and cat intake in the country, and we are the highest that has one impound facility, have the highest intake that all the animals come through one facility. And it is also, Dallas is one of the most difficult animal control situations still in the country. I know we live in it, so we don't see it as much, but talking to my counterparts across the country, the things we're dealing with are still, it's one of the most challenging in the country. Next slide, please. Just a real high-level view of what my department looks like. We have four divisions: field, shelter, medical, and administration. It consists of 219 positions, 174 of which are FTEs, and 45 which are temp, which are extremely important to our operation. My team, very early after I got here, we really wanted to say, what are we about to try to accomplish what City Council and the residents of Dallas want? And the principles that drive us when we have to make these extremely difficult decisions all day long, it's public safety, compassion, and no shortcuts. And there's a lot in the animal world that people take shortcuts on both sides. It ends up badly. There's shortcuts on not trying to get animals out alive that you could work harder and try to find a positive outcome for, and then there's shortcuts on animals that are going to cause a danger to the public. So we are really trying to use data and facts as to what drives us through on these. This slide here is arguably, in my opinion, one of the most important slides in this entire presentation. The dots represented on this slide are loose dog bites for fiscal year 19 inside the city of Dallas. To me, what's even more alarming is the red dots represent dogs that we have an owner for that were involved with a loose dog bite. The blue dots are ones that we never were able to find an owner for. There's a couple of slides later with the total number. I think it's 558 for all of the dots, but I can tell you that 77% of the loose dog bites are, we have an owner behind those. And you've got to remember, think of the red dots, you've actually got people on both sides. You've got an owner, you've got a dog in the middle, and you've got a victim on the other side of it. So loose dog bites are the single most risk for Dallas residents. Loose dog bites are the single most risk for Dallas residents right now. We also track in the house bites and things of that. We don't have much effect over that. We have effect on loose dogs, so that's what we try to throw our energy at, is reducing this number. Next slide. And quick high-level overview of our field operations, and Manager Barnes will certainly be able to talk more in depth afterwards if need be, but you can see the intake for our field intake. We were over 20,000 last year. Something I said for my very first interview all the way through is that returning animals back to their owner is critical. It helps relieve stress on the shelter. It gets the animal back to their owners. You don't have to find a new home for it. And one of the things that drew me to Dallas, City Council had passed ordinances that took effect early in 2017 that was that included fix-it tickets. And we've got a whole slide on citations. But the fact that we're able to get that animal back to the resident with some compliance citations that can be dismissed later has had a huge, huge effect and helped us to be able to get animals home, as well as more microchips in the animals. I think it's over 33% of the animals are coming with a microchip now, which is one of the reasons our return to owner is so high. Next slide. Yeah. So this talks about service requests is the first illustration. This is the first, or 19 was the first year we started breaking follow-up calls, which is the top gray area. The yellow calls are proactive calls from our care team and our officers. The city manager, since my first day here, has really, really pushed on see something, do something to all of his directors. He said, you have your people see something. Try not to wait for a call to get in. If it needs to get done, get it done. So the team had already started on this path, and we found it. We have it in our performance matrix for our officers, that of how many proactive calls that they have to do. And we are seeing that the more proactive calls we have It's equaling less calls that the residents need to call in, and we're getting better results because we're dealing with something while it's happening, not from a call that's been dispatched for 8 hours to us before we could get to it. As you move over, the five-year citation outcome, we just pulled these numbers for the first time after the fiscal year, and it's really, really interesting. I want to explain a couple of the terminology. So the yellow, orange section, those are dismissed with compliance. Those are our fix-it tickets. So that is microchip. All dogs have to be spayed and neutered in the city of Dallas, and rabies shot. If you get those services done within 3 weeks, the citation is dismissed. I think it's a wonderful plan. People are copying that all over the country now. It's a good way that you can do enforcement in all of southern Dallas, and some zip codes above I-30 are part of the SURGE project, which helps totally free of cost for the residents to get those services included on the SURGE project. So huge effect. So if you can look from when there wasn't very much enforcement, even just writing tickets alone can just put people back. That section so big in fiscal year 19 of compliance citations, is over 7,000 citations were dismissed with compliance. I think it's more than almost three times as many as all the citations that were written in 15 together. The light blue above that are tickets. It says upheld, but I want to make sure you understand. These are all Class C misdemeanors. None of these are deemings or administrative pieces. Those are all basically guilty. The charge was guilty. The gray area on top are tickets that got overturned, not guilty. And then the dark blue at the bottom are still unanswered. They're still outstanding. So when you look at that in the pie format, when you take out the unresolved citations, 56.4% of the citations in 19 went on that dismissed with compliance, which I'm really impressed that Dallas came up with that way to help people get into compliance without having to set them back on being all punitive. Okay. Next slide. This the fiscal year 19, that's the numbers that were behind the map with all the dots that shows the difference with loose dog bites in comparison. The dark blue are owned loose dog bites, and the light blue are unowned loose dog bites. So we are seeing a downward trend. We have seen a slight spike in the first quarter of this year. And so we're just keep plugging away because that's the number that we want to try to get. People should be able to walk to their mailbox with feeling safe. They should be able to go to the park and feel safe and not have to be attacked by any loose dogs. All right, into dangerous dogs. It's important to understand, and I know the council that was here in 18, we spent months and months on this, and really defined there's a couple of different areas. There's dangerous dog, there's an aggressive dog, and then there's serious bodily injury. And I'll very quickly hit the definitions of those three, and then we'll talk about some of the distinctions. So dangerous dog is defined by the state. The city can't redefine that. And the definition the state gives for dangerous dog is a dog that makes an unprovoked attack on a person that causes bodily injury while outside of its enclosure. The second part of that that's been a huge piece of discussion is commits an unprovoked act in a place other than its enclosure that reasonably causes a person that the dog will attack and cause injury. That's the state defining it. All right, the next slide is aggressive dog, which is a city ordinance that we put in. We had many, many attacks, animal-on-animal attacks, and there was nothing that we could do about them unless a person got bit in the process also. There was nothing that we could do. So, again, on that same task force in 2018, everyone agreed that we needed to be able to address animal-on-animal attacks as well. Now, with that, it doesn't have the piece about was somebody scared in it. There has to be a verified injury for the animal to be deemed aggressive. And I think it's really important for everybody to know they hear words like dangerous and aggressive. Those are not true animal behavior words. These deal with the law. So you could be a service animal. You could have been to all kinds of training. These laws speak to the incident, not to the overall behavior. People say, why don't you do behavior testing on those animals after that? Because that's not a component of this. It has to do with the act is where that term comes in. And then the next slide is a third category, that's serious bodily injury. That is a state law, and that is characterized solely on the injury. Doesn't have to do with provocation, doesn't have to do with in the enclosure, not in the enclosure. It has to do with the injury. Okay. Next slide. Okay, this kind of brings some of that together, and I know that it's, you know, we look at these kind of things all the time, but it's a chart that kind of shows different elements for each of the aggressive, dangerous, and serious bodily injuries. So I won't read them all, but we'll certainly answer any questions on them. But like provocation is not an element for aggressive. It's if an unrestrained animal attacks and injures a legally restrained animal. So provocation isn't a component. It is for dangerous dog, as you saw by the state law, and it is not for serious bodily injury. It's all on the injury. Okay, so with the next slide, and Sergeant Hughbanks is going to just pass out, these are a couple of cases that are finished. This is an example of what an investigation file looks like for DAS. So she's going to walk around so that you can flip through and see the level of investigation. But for dangerous and aggressive dog, this is the process that goes through in investigating a potential deeming. By law, it requires a sworn affidavit. The state requires a sworn affidavit for a dangerous dog investigation to begin. Aggressive was mirrored very similar in state law, and so the city required that a sworn affidavit must take place. Once an affidavit is received, that is when an official dangerous or aggressive investigation is kicked off by DAS. I keep myself removed from the investigation because ultimately what you are looking at in a packet will be presented for me to look to see if it meets the elements of a dangerous or an aggressive dog. Those facts are then presented to me. I make a determination based on the facts. And again, those definitions that we showed a couple of slides ago, that's what it has to meet in order to be deemed. And then after that, there is an opportunity for an appeal with the courts if they disagree with my decision. Next slide. These two graphs are showing, again, the number of loose dog bites in comparison to deemings that were upheld. So as Mr. Brodsky said, it was in the low 70s last year, 18 and 19, the numbers of cases that were deemed. Approximately about the same were upheld, about eight or so were not upheld for various reasons. And then the graphic to the right just shows in comparison again so you can see the number of loose dog bites as to what ultimately equals all of the elements for an animal to be deemed dangerous. Next slide. Okay, then when I came here, this challenge is not given very often anywhere in the country to say increase intake while increase live release rate. They just don't usually go together. And that is what, when I was hired, was given to me from council, city manager, everyone was to work on both. So you can see that the live release rate, it's very simple. It is the number of outcomes divided by the number of positive outcomes. So an animal dies in our care, that's not a positive outcome and goes against our live release rate. We have the hardest calculation you could make. At the end of the fiscal year, it was 86.4% for dogs and cats. We're extremely proud of that work. I don't like the 90 number itself because we know the animals that didn't leave. We openly talk as much as it hurts us to. We acknowledge that we still have to euthanize for space from time to time, and that is what we're trying to eliminate. And we are, our D90 program, is we've seen calculating those numbers, it'll be well over 90 once we're not euthanizing for space. Okay. The graphic next to that just shows a comparison, and I think it was Councilman Blewett that we were talking about some things, and I shot him this just on a spreadsheet, which really, again, we stare at these graphs all the time, but that graph on the right shows that even with the 12,399 more dogs and cats that entered our care than 2016, total euthanasia has decreased by 5,257. So 46% increase in intake with a 52% decrease in overall euthanasia. The team is working their tails off. It is really, really hard. The 39,000 plus animals, they are really working extremely hard, finding positive outcomes whenever they can. Next slide just shows the overall decrease in euthanasia, dropping down 72% from when you go back to fiscal year 12. So when there's allegations that either Ed Jamieson or my team doesn't want to find positive outcomes, it's just not true. Team works very hard every day. Next slide. This goes to my team. They are amazing for the challenge that was given to them, that the country is coming in. We have people in our building every month that are shadowing different areas, just watching on how we do things. And we are so far from perfect. I want to make sure everybody knows that. We have so many things at our Tuesday meetings that we are drilling down on that we say we have to get better on. This is an area that's not, I think in one of the graphs I sent you guys. It showed you one of our weekly meeting measurements that we do to try to catch things before they get too far off. But I encourage them to be innovative. I encourage them to dream big. And so we started applying stuff with these for grants with these ideas. And it's great. The whole country is really, really excited about it. And I couldn't be more proud to have the people that work at BAS. And if you don't know them, you should be very proud of the people that work there. And the last slide is just looking forward. You guys are aware of our 360 measures. We really, really stretched on some, but we're watching our response time. We're really happy. We're at 94% on our timely response time for priority calls. So the addition of the dispatchers, the in-house dispatchers you all approved that went in effect is big. It helps sort out once it comes from 311, and they do more in-depth routing and get more information, and officers can just respond to calls. There is a huge piece on the humane education that I know Councilman West, I think we've got a meeting coming up soon, and Councilman Basil Dula, we spoke. But the last component of the BCG had to do with education, getting out and changing culture. We believe that the best way is with the youth, and hearing council meetings, I believe that's what overall this body believes also. So we've been working with Fran diligently on this, of trying to get curriculum into the school district on proper animal care, how to get resources, and following that up with resources in the area that the curriculum is being taught. So it's in the semi-early stages. However, we have had some meetings with DISD, and as we have a more big plan, we're going to be coming with you because we really would like your support. We think that that is a very sensible answer on trying to change long-term culture on how people look at their animals in the city of Dallas. And with that, that concludes the presentation, and we'll be happy to answer anything that you have.
Chairman Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Ed, thanks for the presentation. I was here when we had the tragedy that happened in District 7, and it was traumatic for all of us that were on the council at the time. Where we were then to where we are now is, I can't even come up with the words to talk about the transformation that's taking place. Peter, I want to thank you for your leadership, having BCG to come to the table, having private dollars to do that study. And I commend everyone who was within city leadership at the time who provided the transparency of the data, because BCG couldn't have done the job they did if they didn't have the good, the bad, and even the ugly, in order to come back with the recommendations. All seven recommendations, Peter, when we first sat down and we talked about this, and I think we sat down with representatives from BCG, and they walked each one of us through it. I can speak specifically for those who represent the Southern Dallas districts that have been impacted by this, the loose dogs that have run rampant in Dallas, but specifically in Southern Dallas, and colleagues who were not on the council at that time. I'm going to ask if staff can provide a summary, because it's critically important for you to understand where we are now compared to where we were then. So you can go back and you can read that information and understand how, you know, tragic and how dangerous things where people did not feel safe who lived in Southern Dallas at all. Walking around with golf clubs was a common thing as they were walking for exercise in the morning or jogging. Seeing people with golf clubs was not unusual, and sticks. And I don't see as many golf clubs and sticks as I did at one point in time. And so out of tragedy has come you, Mr. Jameson. If it wasn't for the tragedy that took place, I don't think we would have gone to the depth in looking for our next director of animal services. The one recommendation that was not accepted initially was for Dallas Animal Services to be a standalone department. But thank you to City Manager T.C. Broadnax. When you came in, you said, well, we need to do that. And that has made a tremendous difference. Being able for our residents to be able to pick up the phone and call Dallas Animal Services, and then also for the council to say, you know what, having people, the dogs are out at night. The dogs are out early in the morning. And for us to go to 7-day having animal service, being able to go out 7 days a week, being able to go out at night when people would see the dogs was critically important. One of the biggest complaints that we received was the fact that we see the dogs at night and no one is available to go out to, as Councilman Warner used to say, pick up the dogs. A tremendous amount of progress has been made. I want to commend those who are in the nonprofit, private foundation arena for putting the dollars up. The initiative, Spay and Neuter Network, and other entities who would come and set up actual service where you could bring your dog, or they would pick your dog up and take your dog, have it spayed and neutered, and brought it back. I can speak because at the time I said I was a reluctant dog owner. My dog, Jackson. Jackson was picked up. Jackson was spayed and neutered, and he was brought back, and he was brought back in better condition than he left. And so I can personally speak about how much of an impact this has made in Southern Dallas. One of the big things we began to talk about, how do we get more people to get their dogs spayed and neutered? We know in the African American community, dog fighting was just a cultural thing. It was a cultural thing. And so people understanding, first of all, it's the law. City of Dallas, we have a law that says if you own a dog, it needs to be spayed and neutered. And then other decisions that have been made have helped us to get where we are now. So I commend you. My time for round one is almost up. I have a couple of questions. I'll come back in round two. But thank you for your work, Peter. Thank you, Ed, for stepping in, stepping up, and taking ownership of this. And we need more like you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Chairman Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Thomas, I think you'll thank everybody in the world about this project, and Peter and Jameson and the city of Dallas. I was here also, but go to page 8. And I look at this page 8, and back then we were looking at council districts. And I am really want to focus down on council district. District 8 probably the worst one. Probably had more loose dogs, more bite, because people came to District 8 and just dumped their dogs down. And I would love to see out of this, Jameson, what you came about. How did you focus on this? What was the positive and what was the negative? Did this study show throughout the whole city now, but did it actually go down and broke it down by district?
Yes, Councilman, I'm going to let Manager Barnes speak a little bit more to the utilization of heat maps, but they were very, very critical in looking at areas. We still dispatch the aggressive dog team. That was a budget enhancement from a year ago. They use a heat map based on dog bites activity to go, and it's amazing. We just watch the map change color when they're working their area. But Manager Barnes, we want to speak a little bit about heat maps. Districts, but we really break them down even smaller, but District 8 is a very busy district.
Well, the reason why I said District 8, because it was number one, because it had more land, they go and drop the dogs off. And then also, Jameson, you probably do not have enough employees, you know, to manage that area, you know, because I know you're still short-handed.
I do know when I stopped by your office about a little less than a month ago, there was a pretty serious attack down there.
Right.
That backyard disappeared in the woods and ravines and everything that it, and a couple of the dogs involved with that supposedly lived in the woods, a couple were owned. But, Ann, we want to talk about quickly about heat maps?
Sure. As the director said, we use heat maps specifically for dog bites. We not only break them down by district, but we break them down at times of the day when we see bites occurring and days of the week. And the aggressive ops team that council gave us a year ago is the one that works those calls. And we also not only use, the team uses patrolling by district, time, date. We also use trank guns. We use trapping, different methods like that to get the animals out of those areas. We also have a bite team that focuses on catching dogs that have bitten to make sure that we remove them and get them into quarantine. So there are specific people related to bite animals.
If you look at district, I'm just thinking about District 8, and which many articles written about District 8, you know, most of the people drop dogs off and had many bites. But the territory is different. You know, Cleburne, Riley, it's a big field, a whole lot of trees to go. But what do you come to the conclusion? How do we attack that problem? There is still a problem there. You know, Mr. Jameson, I came there and I spoke to you about that. There's still a major problem with Cleburne, Riley. There's still a major problem between 35 and Polk, you know, in those areas. You know, we walk those areas. There's a problem how the citizen cannot walk in their neighborhood. They still walk around with clubs and golf clubs and baseball bats and sticks right now as of today. But when we go out there, but it looked like the culture is not it changing, but we still had an issue. Is that a marketing issue? Is it a focal issue? I mean, what are we doing wrong or what we could do much better?
Well, we encourage the citizens to call 311 because that's how the information gets on the heat map. I also have specific ops teams that go to that area at least weekly, if not more. But we have to know about those dogs in order to address it. The areas that you just gave me, I can pull up data to see if we're getting the calls and how often our ops teams are in that area.
Are we doing a better job in educating the citizen when to call 311 and when to call 911? There's a difference because majority of the people say, hey, I call 311, nothing happened. I call 911, there's nothing happened. How are we educating the citizen to how to call and when to call?
We certainly are trying on that front, and we communicate with 311 a whole lot, and we communicate with 911 quite a bit also. That any of the aggressive activity, the direct bites goes through 911, animal cruelty goes through 911, and every other type of animal call comes through 311. There's supposed to be a connection if it goes to the wrong one. I do hear that sometimes that doesn't make it. 311 gets to us faster, where 911 gets to the police faster. As far as outreach, you know that we have Officer King, who actually is stationed in your southern office.
Yes,
one day a week, or are you
one day
more
a week.
Than that now?
One okay. day a week.
You know, at least one day a week, which we want to be in the communities. I believe every council member got a invite. We would like to come out in February and March as we get around. We would love to go to one of your meetings, meeting of your choosing in February or March, and talk to the residents in your area about the issues that are important to them in their area. But I don't think I've ever said no to a council request to come to a meeting. Please request us. Well, that we have not got the department there. I can't be to every meeting, but we have people who specialize in going to meetings and high-level people that are able to answer questions. So please invite us to anything and everything, right down to an HOA meeting, that if it's an important HOA in an area, we want to be there.
Okay, so when someone, walk me through, when someone called 911, aggressive dog, there, are we gathering the data, the respond time, when someone responds to that? If so, what is that time? Do we have that?
Yes, we do. And this I'm going to let Manager Barnes handle because she communicates with 311 and 911 and the flex questions for how things get routed that give different priorities.
If 311 gets an aggressive call or 911, either way, it's a priority one call. It gets dispatched to us, and the response time is tracked in our data system. We respond to those calls with, we're at about a 93% response time rate, which is to respond within 30 minutes. Now, if there is an active attack that raises the response, and PD is part of the responders because they can make it to a scene quicker than we can, and those calls are responded to immediately. They take priority over everything else, and to us and PD.
So walk the community to, if you got a 911, the DPD is responding to the incident.
Correct.
And when they arrive, do ambulances respond behind them?
Correct.
And what do DPD do when they get there?
DPD, when they arrive, their first thing is to make sure that the person is okay.
Okay.
When we are usually right behind them, and then our priority is to secure the dog.
Right. And this is 24-hour service, 24/7, right?
Yes, thanks to council.
Okay. Question is number one, that when do the ambulance service look at the city as a whole by zip code or by district? How do y'all look at it? I mean, how do you deploy your employees?
We do it many different ways, but as far as daily assignments for the officers, it's broken down into five areas for dispatching.
And what is the five areas? Is there overlap with DPD or what?
More with code.
With code?
Because we were with code, so it kind of adopted that way. But they're called 109 lower and upper. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. But we basically have it's split by 35 and 30 in quarters.
Right.
And then we assign officers based on call volume in those areas, and that's right. Where our in-house dispatchers help with assignments, and then we also have supervisors, working supervisors in the field, also helping with those assignments to make sure that priority calls are handled efficiently.
Well, Jameson, a question to you with personnel. I just wonder, are we shorthanded? Are we need more? Because some districts, some part of the city is much larger. How do you deploy your personnel? I mean, are you shorthanded? Do you need more? I mean, where are we?
We can't do with less. I can tell you that for sure. We have right-sized. It took a lot since the beginning of the budget cycle to get the new additions in, and we're almost fully there. Am I correct? The positions that were allocated on this last budget. Obviously, more just equals more of something. So we certainly can be faster.
I guess it would be precise. In the ideal world, that you is your department, and you got the whole city to focus on, will you say you may be 5 short or 10 short? I mean, you can't cover, because I have spoken to you offline and spoke to some of the animal service people. You are shorthanded. You cannot cover. You cannot respond in a timeline you can do, because, like you said, if you go to Cleveland Riley, you know, you got a whole lot of area. You can't walk. You know, you got to drive. So you might need 3 or 4 people there just to cut that data down. So I'm just asking direct to you.
Yeah. Well, directly in a perfect world, as you ask, we do work out of Southeast, Southeast Service Station. There are teams that launch out of there. But in a perfect world, we would have an operating substation that we actually did impounds at as well. That was a fully functional operating station and dispatched directly out of there as well. So we now have to launch people and get them into the areas and hope they're in their areas as the calls come. So if you're asking a perfect world,
right,
it takes a lot of staffing to staff a building that people are going to come and get the animal and veterinary care and kennel cleaners and the whole nine yards. But that's in the perfect world, is there would be another station in southern Dallas that everything was done out of there as well, as opposed to it all being on Northwest Moreland.
And again, thank you for your service, and thank you for your personnel to come to District 8 and to the community office. And they come out there, and I mean, it's like a daycare. You know, they pick up the dog and take it by a concierge. It's great. And again, thank you for your service, what you're doing for District 8. Thank you also, Peter.
Mr. Magoo.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So I want to just really start by also saying thank you. We've been dealing with these issues for a long time. I'm thinking back to 05, 06, all the way through 10 and 11, and when many of us that were, you know, I'm one that has been chased by several dogs in my work in the city and have had very personal experiences in many areas of southern Dallas, where you just look up, and this is kind of a litmus test for a city. If you just look around and say you can't even pick up stray dogs, what are you doing with the rest of the city? And this is really the first time I've felt like we're going in the right direction for a long time. And so I want to say thank you for Peter, for your leadership your resilience through this. It's tough. It's been, you've had some tough moments to get to this place, and a lot of those on your task force and our commissioners and all those that have been advocates for a long time that are generally all wanting the same things. It's just the belief. I mean, you said it earlier, this belief that we couldn't pick up the dogs and also increase the live release rate was a huge, huge just point. I think many of us that were working on these issues believed we could. And to see the results and see the fruits of some of the work that, that y'all are all doing here, I want to say thank you for that, because that has been sort of the mind shift that has said we can do all this better. And while we're not there, we got a lot more work to do. You've heard some of the issues. You continue to hear other issues. A lot of us love our pets and love dogs and love animals and want to get the live release rate up to 100, but also have to look at the realities of what we're facing in our communities. I think the more education, the more we're doing the right things now. Used to it, we'd ask these questions at these briefings, and the answers we got, we just knew weren't true. And, you know, I remember showing up at the shelter to have discussions and ask questions, and, you know, 14 layers of people came to keep me from looking at what was actually happening inside the shelters. And it just felt totally different. So, and to that point, I want to go back, and there's someone, we don't always necessarily thank our media partners, but Sharon Grigsby has been a voice in this place for a long, long time, and she's been an advocate writing on some of these issues when many people just wanted to complain, and she always had some good advice, some good suggestions in bringing light to these issues, and so I wanted to thank her as well. So I just say keep doing what you're doing. Please continue to work with us. Know that you got allies here. Know that we're encouraged by the progress we've made, but want to keep moving everything in the right direction. And please continue to do what you're doing. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Chairman Narvaez.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm really proud of to see the bad past and the amazing current that we're in, and really excited about what and how we continue this to have an even more an amazing future. And so I want to thank you all, the Dallas Animal Services staff. Ed, I know you always make sure your team gets all the credit. It's not just you on your own. Every time we talk, you always bring up your staff, and so I want to make sure your entire staff knows that that I at least recognize all their efforts. I also like how you said in this briefing that you recognize, you and your team, y'all recognize your deficiencies, and y'all are being proactive instead of reactive. And that's the sign of a great leader and somebody who realizes that, you know, we're not perfect, and you didn't take over something that was perfect and just make it better. You took over something that was it was in disaster mode. And between you and the commission, y'all work together. And so I want to thank the commissioners and our chairman for that. And because, colleagues, what's really awesome is that now Dallas Animal Services is winning awards. They're winning grants. We have people showing up to tour to see the success. How did you go from euthanizing 19,000 animals and dropping that down 72% in a short 7 years? It seems like a long time, but that's lightning speed for many other animal facilities. So I want to thank you all for that. And then recently, there was a time when I would have told anybody before I got on the council and learned a lot more about DOS that I would have told anybody, do not take an animal there. This is way before your time. And because it was like that rate that we saw change, it was like, no, that animal's going to be euthanized. It has no chance. But because of all the success this past New Year's, I guess it was day morning because it was about almost 1 a.m. My partner and I walked into our apartment complex, and in our lobby there was this loose dog. And really sweet, nice. I'm assuming she was like a blue heeler. And so we didn't want to leave her there. She looked very scared. And I didn't know what to do because I've never had a loose dog in the complex before. They're always with a human, you know. And so we looked around, we walked around, and, you know, she was very nervous, scared. I'm sure the bullets and the fireworks of the night, somebody had obviously put her into the building. She was probably in the street beforehand, so I'm thankful to whomever did that. At least she was in a safe spot during that time, so a car didn't hit her on West Commerce Street. Because that time, people were leaving downtown from their celebrations. And the next morning, I contacted Ed, because so Jesse and I had a two-minute talk about what do we do with this dog? And I wanted to just leave her in the more enclosed portion of the lobby. And he's like, no, we're taking her into the apartment. And I said, you know, bring her. She seems really sweet. She's not, you know, aggressive in any way. She's just very scared. We took her in. She was very hungry. But I was like, we live in an apartment. I can't keep her. But by the morning, we had fallen in love with her. And I had named her Azul, which is the worst thing to do when you're, quote, unquote, fostering a loose animal. But I did make the call. And Ed's folks were there in about half an hour. And my biggest concern was I want to know, you know, who adopted this beautiful dog, super sweet dog. And within whatever the holding period we changed to, I think it's 5 days, the following Monday, her new owner picked her up. She was spayed and had all her shots, and she was microchipped at that point. And there's a resident in Dallas who is now, I don't know what he named her. I named her Azul, which means blue in Spanish. But that's the success story that I get to share now about Dallas Animal Services, because there was a time when I wouldn't have done that. And now I tell people all the time, go to DOS, go to DOS, go to DOS. That dog or that cat, that animal will be treated with dignity and respect, and our team will do everything in their possible power to make sure it gets a home. So congratulations. I know we hit 89.9. We were so, so freaking close. But, you know, I'm calling it 90, and I know with this year coming up, we're going to get there because everybody is all about what we're doing there, and it's only going to get better. So thank you, and congratulations to everybody at DOS. And with that, I'll yield my time, Mr. Mayor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Basil Dua.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And I just wanted to give a big thank you as well to the increase in numbers. I wanted to say that I adopted two dogs from you in a couple days after Thanksgiving, and it's really made our family very happy. One of them is named Dallas now. And so I just want to say thank you for all the work that you've done. I before running for office, considered myself an animal activist, and we're crazy. I know that. And there was a lot of crazy, if you will, in this city because something wasn't being done. And I feel like something is really being done. And from my own personal experience in block walking from 2017 to 2019, I'll tell you right now, Mr. Thomas is right. I wanted to carry a golf club with me while I was knocking on doors during election season because of the amount of loose dogs that were in District 7. And I want to say that I noticed tremendous difference this other time around in several parts of the district that was really prominent for dumping dogs and for there being a lot of infractions of loose dogs. And it just didn't exist anymore. And that was also off of the list of the most common things that came out of the mouths of constituents when I talked about what the biggest, you know, at that time when we saw with where y'all's numbers showed, it was came right off the tongue of people's mouths. They were tired. They couldn't go to their mailbox. They couldn't walk their own dogs. They couldn't walk, you know, their kids in strollers in some neighborhoods. So it's extremely important to address that from a quality of life standpoint. But I commend you. I applaud you. And I want to support in any way I can to increase the efficiency of y'all's efforts to prioritize the dogs or the animals' well-being through that process. So thank you for that, and I think that it's amazing that we are leading the industry in the country. So keep it up. Let us know how we can help. Thank you.
Mr. Kleinman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and I do want to thank both Peter and Ed for really turning the tide on animal care in the city of Dallas. This is a very different briefing than we used to have a few years ago when I first joined the council, and I'm very pleased to say it's really a very positive briefing. I think that if you look at our budget, you see that public safety is the number one priority in this city. And with y'all keeping that in mind and still being able to increase the live release rate, to reduce the number of loose animals in the city, and all these other things, all these positive things that your department can do on top of keeping our citizens safe, which is by far the number one reason for having DAS. I really have a lot of accolades and appreciate the work. People tend to anthropomorphize animals, but they are not citizens, and the reason we have animal control is to make sure our citizens remain safe, and I appreciate that y'all keep that as your number one priority and would like you to continue to do that. Thank you.
That's the word of the day right there, brother. Anthropomorphize. I'll say it again, Lee. Hit one more time.
Anthropomorphize.
Wow, that's good. That's good. That's the SAT word. Chairwoman Gates.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Lee, for giving us an SAT word of the day. I will echo and repeat some of the colleagues. Thank you for all your good work from the commission and to the Dallas Animal Services and for keeping our citizens safe. So I think you understood what you were charged with, and you've worked with the community and worked with us to achieve those goals. With regards to the dangerous dogs as well as aggressive dogs, I know it's been brought to your attention, and I know we increased the fees, correct, and their cost recovery from $50 to $250 for registration?
Yes. That's in the appendix, but it was raised to $250 from $50.
And in the appendix, you also show what actual the cost is to the city. So I know with fees, we have to be at least cost recovery. We can't charge more. And so that is justified, those fees. Is that correct?
Correct. And this came from the fee study. We didn't ask for this fee study. We were going to go on lowering adoption fees was an interest of us. We weren't actively going out and looking on the cost for some of the other things that the study did. But that's what the study showed. And as you see, it's the single most cost, even though it's a very small percentage of the calls and the work that we do. It's it is the most cost to the department.
So the full cost, which is, is brought to my attention. So people question if there really was associated with the cost of the fee. But you could see with the independent fee study, it was $6,000, right, for the registration. And that's because of all the paperwork involved?
Correct, and investigative work and the upkeep of it, yes.
Okay. I did have a question on, I think we have some, and I'll bring it to you, just some inconsistencies of how we post the information related to, like, is it a recurring cost? I mean, this is an annual cost, correct? It's not just a one-time registration.
My understanding was it was supposed to be the recurring cost, but the way that it came presented with the other fee changes, I believe it got written as only the one-time registration. Am I wrong on that? But the intent was for it to be a yearly, but that's not the way that it was presented in the
So how are we treating it if somebody
It's the one time right now as written, as the ordinance is written. We would have to come to council to change the ordinance.
Okay. So when an animal is deemed dangerous or aggressive, right, either one is categorized then at $250 as a one time.
Yes, on the initial.
But they would still have to register that animal annually.
And right now, each year, that would be $50 fee.
Okay, so that's what we're practicing. And that's how I think there's an inconsistency in what we've put out, that the owner of a dangerous dog shall renew registration. I think we're saying that, but we're not really, that's not a practice. Okay, so I just want to make sure that we fix that. And then, again, on if you'll clarify, because there's been some question of are we following state law? Are we compliant with state law?
We absolutely are. The city attorney's office can speak more in depth if they would like to. And there's so many components of the state law, the attorney investigation, on the deeming, on the hearing. But absolutely, I
And the appeal process as well, on how someone can appeal.
Yes, and then the city attorneys can chime in if they feel that they should. Lawyers all have different opinions. I'm married to one. If they had the same opinions, we wouldn't need lawyers. I love my lawyer. I haven't won an argument against her, but I do love my lawyer.
You lose all arguments? Is that what you said?
I have not won an argument in my home since I've been married. I will say there are differences of opinions. I know the opinion of the city attorney. Everything we do on the legal aspect is run through our legal department. And there is differencing opinions, and that happens. I can tell you, we had BPD in when certain things were being alleged. I want to know if I'm being alleged of doing something, I bring people in, come and look at it. So Dallas Police Department did a study of our dangerous dogs and our investigations. And just a brief portion, Dallas Police detectives reviewed several cases and current operating procedures. Detectives also reviewed the Texas Health and Safety Code statute regarding dangerous dogs and found the Dallas City ordinance is consistent in language. It is broad in scope and focused on the actions of the animal and the belief of the victim. After reviewing the processes of DAS officers, Dallas detectives found DAS investigations to be strong, consistent, thorough, and intensive. So that's an outside party that wasn't us in their view.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing that. You've done great work. My only request, and you've said we can always do better, right? There's always areas. It's just that we have the consistency if it's related to what we're putting out there publicly, related to these fees, what we're charging, and continue all the effort. So thank you. Thank you for the presentation and all the data associated with it.
Chairwoman Arnold.
Thank you. Good morning. And I will simply say once again, thank you and muchas gracias. Add a little color to here, flavor. And that speaks to culture that we need to continue to work on around here. I don't want to start calling all these things because I'll mess up like I did a few minutes ago, Mayor, and had to come back and straighten that up. So I appreciate your patience when I left someone off. But Mr. Broadnax, I want to definitely thank you. I can get your name correct. That you did hire Mr. Jameson. And what I do appreciate so much, because I work more, I think I've come in contact with you more, is that you're always mild and mannered, and I appreciate that, and professional. Mr. Broski is always, he's always kind of smooth as well, but he's not on staff here. But I do appreciate that, and it may just speak to just your operation. So when I arrived in 2015, we were in a, I won't use the word that Mr. Climbing news, but it was said to repeat what the mayor used to say, conundrum, bula. We had all of that and more, especially in District 4. And it was my call to pick up the dogs that folks kind of teased me on, but actually, based on the reports that we finally got with Mr. Brodsky's team, we really felt like we had more loose dogs than we had residents in District 4. The math was just amazing. So we appreciate those efforts. But I also want to stress this, and this is where I'm going here, Mayor, who you're with us presently, and some of the old members. What we're seeing from the mayor's task force data just released and the police department's incident maps, the data that we had in 2016 would overlap with their documentation, because that's where we were getting all of the attacks. And District 4 was number one in those incidents. So I really need to know, I need to have that map so that I can see where we are, where we've made progress, because I want to overlap with the mayor's task force and the Dallas Police Department's data so that we can continue the advocacy. Yes, we can do more. We understand that. But I'm grateful for the work that you all have given to this point. The other thing I wanted to mention, because we are going into budget season, and I thank Mr. Councilmember from 8, Atkins, for bringing this up. Just as he used to have a site for dog dumping, also we have the same issue in District 4 with Fruitdale, so I need to get a report on that. And it also speaks to the mayor's task force. That is one of those areas where you don't have much lighting, and we need to have an infrastructure. I've spoken to the marshals about that. the lighting might help us to offset some of the dumping there, but that it gives me the credibility and the data that I need to drive that request for lighting in that area so we're not seeing all the dog dumps. So I did want to mention that. Also, since we're in budget season, I can speak to the fact that I did get a chance to, in 16, to ride in the car with the dog catcher, and I don't know if that's the proper word now, dog catcher operator technician, but I rode in the car. Councilwoman Young and I rode in the dog in the truck. You had one officer. The officer had to catch the dog, sometimes go talk to the residents, and then pick up the dog, or either stop and give the resident information about the dog, and then he had to get back in the truck to put the data in. And I'm sitting here going, how in the world, how many dogs can you catch when you have to do that alone? You see what I'm saying? And so my advocacy then was for more trucks and more staffing. So have we increased our staffing since 2016 to a decent level, in your opinion?
We absolutely has been increased to a decent level. I knew the city manager was really big when I saw the people. I said, I need the vehicles and all the equipment that goes along with them, or else that officer's not adding the value that we need. And it did. We, I want to throw the wrong number, but 12-ish new vehicles this last year, animal control.
All right, so if we're running, and so I don't want to prolong it, are we still running one operator or are the two?
There's a couple different, and if Manager Barnes needs to jump in, we have teams that do certain things. We have loose dog teams, aggressive dogs teams. They're highly, highly functional at specifically, so aggressive dogs are going into areas with aggressive dogs, looking for dogs that are involved in attacks that we have not been able to impound. Loose dog teams are looking for straight loose dogs, and that's their focus. There's other proactive calls for other violations they can be looking. So some work in teams, but the thing we get judged on with response time, most of them are working on single vehicles. They are the ones that are getting the calls that come through 311, get dispatched, the clock starts running, and they have to start responding to those calls by priority.
All right. And so, and the other reason I'm asking this, too, about the one operator is because I was told, too, I don't know if this is just a statement, but sometimes when you bring the truck out, I was told that the dog can sense the truck and the other one start running. So I figured you need at least one person who can jump out and try to catch that dog while he's running to help the one that's stopping to catch the other dog. So is there really any credibility to that?
Each dog's a little bit different in how they do maneuver around. But there is some truth to that they recognize the vans, the squeaks of the vans. Some of these dogs are just like, man, they know that we're here, and we will send out some of our admin vehicles out in the area to try to give a different look to it. But there is a little bit of nuance to that you are correct. And we had realized that my officers, I can't speak highly enough for what they do, the pounding that they take and the scrutiny they're under. Everybody records everything they do. We can't wait until we have body cameras, which were part of this last budget. We can't wait for that ourselves. But the work those officers do, that they are running towards some things that most people are running the opposite way from, that are going to cause serious harm. And every day, and they care, and they are a huge part of our live release rate on getting information, being able to relay information that ultimately comes to the shelter staff to make good decisions on how we move through with the animals.
So. All right, so, and I didn't see this in the report also, and thank you for that. Are we operating on weekends?
We're 24-7
24-7,
now,
okay.
The last budget.
Very good. On your officers, are these certified peace officers? How are you, what's your training?
Great question. They are not peace officers.
Okay.
They are... They enforce law but are not considered law enforcement. They respond first but are not considered first responders. There is a state, not a certification, but it is a state training that you have to pass to become an animal control officer. But they are not peace officers, which is why Class C misdemeanors are the highest level that we are able to take through to a court.
All right, so you can give the ticket under that with that jurisdiction?
Correct.
All right. And the other piece I wanted to talk about was the police officers. About how many police officers, Dallas police officers, are engaged in our operations on an average? Because I know we brought them in through
regulation. That is a terrific question, and I just was with Chief Anderson yesterday talking about this. We're trying to pull numbers to see how much time Dallas police spends on dog calls to then come with the proper response to City Hall. Would it be that there are officers that are assigned to DAS to solely respond to those dog calls and not have to pull a regular patrol officer off? There are two detectives right now, really two and a half detectives that are assigned, but that's under animal cruelty, which is a felony, and due to a very long task force a year ago, cruelty falls under Dallas Police Department. So there's only two that are officially assigned to us, but I don't want to speak until I see it, but I think those numbers are going to be pretty big, that there is a lot of time responding to dog calls.
So would you get that data as soon as you get that? Because we need to get our police officers on the street, and then we need to come up with a policy or practice so that we can certify officers who can, peace officers or whatever we have to do to give them that job so we can put our police in the street where they need to be. I think that's all I have right now, and I appreciate your patience, but I did want to make sure I get that out. And thank you again for everything that all of you have done. Thank you.
Ms. Mendelson, could you drop off?
Thank you. First, I want to say thank you for my dog, Murphy, who has brought a lot of joy to us as well as daily exercise. So anyone who's thinking of New Year's resolutions and gyms, I'm just going to say go get a high-energy dog from Dallas Animal Services. I actually want to start by thanking the city manager as well, and Nadia, because it's because of the resources you put into this program that has allowed it to be able to be effective. Peter, I think you've been exemplary in terms of your civic involvement and advocacy, and we need a whole lot more people to give the time and energy that you have to this issue, and thank you so much. And I'm going to wait to say something to you, but what I wanted to say is just one overarching theme, which is this is exactly the kind of things I'm hoping to see. So I love that you clearly articulated what is the problem. I love that you provided baseline data. I love that you put national strategies that have proven to work. You've put the leadership behind it, and you've got these great outcomes. This is exactly the kind of thing I'm hoping to see all across the city, and you've done it, and thank you. And I do think it's because of your leadership, Ed, and I think you've been transparent when I've had questions. You have admitted maybe this didn't go as well as it could, or this is why, and you've educated us. And your commitment to continuous quality improvement, even though you are killing it, you're not killing
that
it.
That hurts
you're
my release rate, Councilman.
You're doing great, and I just want to applaud you and all that you have done, and thank you so much.
Mr. Basil Duas, is this your second?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just wanted to – I got caught up giving you guys praise, and I want to just say to please extend the praise to y'all's team. I recognize that there are very few departments that send out notifications of affected services for holidays and things of that nature, and there are certain ones, like our first responders, who are working literally around the clock and even on holidays. So that's a huge component to our public safety and quality of life. So please let all of the foot soldiers know how pleased we are. It's not just for you.
No, absolutely. If I could add on there that the community needs to be thanked. Animal issues are a reflection of the community, the good and the bad. It's a total reflection. And this stuff doesn't work. If they don't report to us, we get no data from 311 that doesn't allow us to develop a plan to get out there. And quite frankly, that's what I was told. I was able to see that clearly. There were certain areas in your district in particular, when we were looking at the fire station in your district to move into, they didn't want us. They were just done calling DAS for anything. So over time, by being there and putting proactive teams in and being friendly, one of the things I encourage my officers to do is to wave at people. Just wave when you're driving by. It's amazing. People, whoa. Then they're starting to wave back at us now. But and could attest to the reception we have in areas that they didn't want us in before. So the community is a huge part. And for us to get to where we ultimately want to go, it is going to take everyone to get there.
Well, I
and the rescue and adopters and everyone.
Well, I really appreciate it. And I have one question, though. On slide 8, this was alarming, or I guess shocking, because of how many are owners that come back. So I'm curious if you could go into detail a little bit about the consequences for each infraction or repeat offenders, or how that goes, like what measures are taken so that we address those dog owners. Because I do believe that the majority of our issues with animal services has to do with neglect and abuse from owners.
Ann, do you want to jump on these? Because she handles the investigation and taking everything forward, so I want to make sure we get the terminology correct.
So loose dog bites can go a multitude of different ways, but I think that at the beginning of the loose dog problem, everybody thought that there was a problem with loose Cujo-type dogs in the city of Dallas. Our data has proven that the problem is with the owners. So this makes it more difficult because now we're not just dealing with a dog, we're dealing with a person, and it makes it more emotional. So at this point, we have to hold the person accountable, not just the dog. So a bite, there's quarantine and all of those processes that we have to do per state law. And a year ago, we instituted the citation that if your dog bites, that citation now holds the owner accountable. So we instituted that. The second thing is dangerous and aggressive dog. If that owner isn't going to take on the responsibility to keep their dog confined and to prevent incidents from happening and provide public safety, then the city and state laws need to come in and ensure that that is done so it doesn't happen again. And we don't want to take their dog away. We just want to ensure that there's going to be a structure at home so it doesn't happen again. So I think that that is really going to be our focus is, if there's loose dog bite incidents, what are we going to do to make sure it doesn't happen again?
So if you go through the process and they are found guilty or convicted, I guess, would you then release the pet back to their owner?
Yeah, let me just slide this in. There's two different components. There's an administrative component, and that's where aggressive and dangerous dog and even serious bodily injury are administrative actions at the court level. A piece that Manager Barnes talked about, the criminal citation part, those are Class C misdemeanors for allowing your dog to bite a human, and then it was discussed at council they wanted to add that same charge for allowing your animal to bite another animal within those elements. So in there, the part of the question as to the when you go in, there are restrictions for owning a dangerous or an aggressive dog, which that's our hope. An owner can get their animal back and follow those restrictions. So we're pretty similar to state with a couple of additions.
So is the owner then, I guess, registered with the city as
correct.
One who – and so as a repeat offender, if it were to happen again, even not even with the same animal as the first instance, because, again, the accountability is on the pet owner. If – you know, I came out with Sparky, and he bit someone, and I got convicted, and then I went out with Zeus, and Zeus did it again. What happens to me at that point?
Well, that's the citation, the administrative part that the director is speaking about. And so we have that history of that citation, regardless on what pet it is that owner has. And that information, when it went in front of the judge that second time, the courts would have that is a second offense. So that judge would see that information. And then it's up to the judge.
And I know the judge would have this, but does it still appear on y'all's system if they opted into deferred adjudication and went through any type of process that the court allowed them?
Yes.
Yes.
And then we also have an ordinance. We call it three strikes you're out ordinance. Where if there's three convictions on there's a series of ordinances that fall under it, but if there's three convictions, we can actually go to court in front of a judge and ask that they not own the dog and the dog become property of the city of Dallas.
Is
but
that
there
a
has
state?
To be
is that a
city ordinance.
Okay. So why does someone have an opportunity to have three instances?
There has to be a conviction. So if they ignore the citation, we can't use that ordinance. The citations have to go to court. But that is a tool in our toolbox.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
You're welcome. Ms. Blackman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And I want to thank you, Ed, and your team, Peter, for your vision, your leadership, and the city manager and his staff for putting the resources in. I mean, I wasn't here, but I was very aware of that, you know, Mallings and not being able to walk across the street, because I too would walk around and, you know, when campaigning, and it can't, it's a public safety issue. But what I really like hearing is that you have a continuous improving model, which, you know, it's not complete and perfect on the first onset, and you recognize where the faults are, and you're willing to go back to the community and ask for input and to continually improve that. And that's real leadership, to admit fault and to fix things, and that's what I appreciate about this approach. And it's never going to be perfect, and it's going to change, but the willing to listen is very reflective in how you are leading a team, and your team is doing very well. So back to the homeowner or the owner bike, how do we work with them? Like, do we ask them to go to training? Because a lot of it has to do with, you know, protecting the domain of a, you know, dogs get very territorial. I have a Chihuahua, and he is fierce, but he doesn't know that. He thinks he's fierce, but he's really not. but I know that he's very protective. I mean, we've been working on that. And so how is there a way that we are working with pet owners to understand how to train an animal to not be fierce? And is that our obligation?
It is really tough. Thank you, Councilwoman. I can tell you, District 9 is busy. The very first week I talked to you about a dog getting killed, another dog reaching through the fence and killing a dog who was literally just being walked down, and a dog. And it has just continued on, and District 9 has been extremely busy. We try to educate. We believe we are operating outside of the scope of what a government really should be doing, and even a government animal shelter across the country on a lot of domains. My thought and my studies and education on when a government shelter dabbles too much into animal behavior, you start to cloud a line on liability down the road also. And so there's been some governments that have gotten themselves in trouble taking on too much, be it the classes, be it that we change this animal's behavior inside our shelter with our programs. It opens, again, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm only taking what lawyers and what some other cases are starting to show trends across the country, is that when you're talking about behavior, the city starts to get themselves in the realms. I have behaviors that work for me. They're terrific. And we do a lot of education. So the DISD is the big long-term picture, getting in when they're young and getting on that. I think that we are open to any other types of education when we're out at community meetings and everything. I'm not a proponent of the classes, because you're basically saying the city said that this animal passed this and now it's okay, so that if and when something happens in the future, it's like the city had gave them a blessing. And I talked to another council person on something like that. That's just my thought and my experience on those, that it's, you check the box, they went through it. But I don't want to say that dog's no longer going to do X, Y, or Z. But if that's, you know, that's always something we can look deeper into. But proper pet ownership, we do offer some resources and education on now, though.
And I do know that we have some commissioners from the animal, I guess it's not the shelter commission anymore. Is it still called the animal shelter? Okay. Advisory. So thank you for your service, because you don't get paid, you don't get recognition, and you get a lot of calls as well. And again, thanks for your leadership and vision, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Thomas, second round.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. As I said, just a couple of things. Page 8, I'll be brief. I think this slide is critical, and if you have this by council district, if you can get that to me, I greatly appreciate it. And this is for you, Mr. Jameson. I know we have a meeting, community meeting, I think coming up in February. If there's any information specifically relates to my district and, you know, loose dog bites or any of that information, if you get that data to me prior to the meeting, that way I'm as informed as I can possibly be. And the last thing, I know around budget time, Councilmember Atkins had made reference to staffing. Around budget time, we asked about, you know, code and how many positions have been allocated, and them having challenges filling positions. I'm curious, are you having any challenges filling positions? Because we got a couple of job fairs that are coming up, and we want to make sure we emphasize this opportunity is available.
Yeah. General Manager Craig, I was at a meeting with DPD yesterday, and we just went over our staffing.
So we are very successfully filling our positions. We are so successful that we are getting these new positions at some of our levels they can promote up and into. So we're always having those kind of entry-level positions available, whether it is those temp slots opening up. But absolutely, we are excited to take place in those job fairs and to be a part of getting more of our residents on board with the city.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Mayor.
Mr. Kleinman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Councilmember Arnold made mention of something that I want to make mention of also, and that DAS would not be in the position with the director they have if our city manager had not hired the way he hired and enabled you to do what you needed to do there. So I do want to thank you, Mr. City Manager TC, for that, and wanted to acknowledge as well, along with all the other thanks. Ms. Arnold.
Just a couple of questions. Just one point. You've done a great job also in education, and we need to continue that. I saw just a rollout of a number of community educational pieces on spay and neutering. We need to continue to work more on the difference between 311 and 911 when you need to make when the constituents need to make calls. But the other piece is we had in 16 a surge of post office. Attacks against post office, postmasters, and as a result, when the postman, a woman, is attacked, it caused the entire street to lose their to interfere with mail distribution. So, are we seeing a decline in those numbers?
We are anxiously waiting for the post office. They put those numbers out really almost a year after, if I'm not mistaken. I was just on that. Was that 2 weeks ago? I was looking at that. But in 2018, that was one of the needs for strengthening some. As I played a video, we had a home video of a postal carrier getting viciously attacked. He was just doing his job, and the letters exploded into the air. I know that the mail carriers are so important to people being able to get their things. Like you said, they will shut it down. One of the stories that got blown up into a dog that hadn't bit yet, what they left out is that it had the mail carrier on top of his truck as the dog was completely coming after it. And we just went through the process on this is what it did. Does it meet this? So I think, unfortunately, I think we are still in the top something not good for a postal carrier attack.
Right, so could you all work to get that data? I need that, especially as it relates to District 4. Yep. And I think just as I move forward, we'll have conversations and probably through a briefing. Since you're with animal services, and I know this is not about all those other animals, but we do need a briefing on the other animals and what you do with exotic animals and the peacocks, you may call that. But, you know, I have peacock issues in my district. And so we just need to know what to do with them when they are attacked. And so I just want to put that there, and I'll follow up with you on the other data requests. Thank you all for everything. Yeah, I do have a community in Clarendon. They have their peacocks are their pets.
You
and so they walk across the street,
that.
Peacock proud. I'm not making this up, Mayor.
She's not making it up.
No, you're not making it up. No.
So they are beautiful.
Order.
They are beautiful.
We'll have order in the chamber.
Thank you so very much, Mayor. And now you know you're going to ride with me to see those peacocks. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm not seeing anybody else who wants to say anything. So I'll just say thank you all for your hard work and the progress that you've made is commendable, and we thank you so much. If there's no further questions or comments from members, you're free to go. Thank you very much. Mr. City Manager.
Thank you, Mayor. And again, as the team leaves the podium area, I do want to acknowledge and thank Nadia Chandler-Hardy for working beside Ed. And so I do have to give her some credit for hiring Ed to come work for us. She managed that process. And so I'm excited about their efforts. So the next item up. As staff walks to the podium, today we're going to be bringing forward to you a residential neighborhood empowerment zone program and the proposed designation of 7 neighborhood empowerment zones. The Office of Economic Development, up until recently, has used neighborhood empowerment zones to support commercial development on a project-by-project basis, but as council is aware, we just extended and created a program for neighborhood empowerment zones to do geographical areas similar to what we're proposing today for housing. So today you'll be briefed on neighborhood empowerment zones to be used to support residential development in areas where property tax values are rising quickly and residents are at risk of displacement. The proposed program includes tax abatements, but we believe that the long-term benefit of growing our tax base and creating new housing for people who work in Dallas and also want to call Dallas home outweigh the minimal cost of these first few years of abatement. So as I've asked staff to brief the entire city council on the proposed zones, I'm going to turn it over to David Nogueira and Pam Thompson, supported by Michael Mendoza in the Department of Housing and Neighborhood Revitalization. David.
Great. Thank you, Mr. City Manager, and thank you, Council, for giving me this opportunity to brief you on the residential neighborhood empowerment zones. If those of you who were part of the Housing and Homeless Solutions Committee yesterday were briefed on our 2020 work plan, and what you'll see is that the neighborhood empowerment zones is one of the items that we have been working on and are rolling out as part of that 2020 work plan. So next slide, please. Great. So I'm going to give you a brief introduction to neighborhood empowerment zones, talk about some of the issues that the tool was designed to address, talk about how it aligns with our comprehensive housing policy. And then we'll go into the program design, program management, monitoring of evaluation, the legal authority that allows us to offer this tool, and some of the challenges that are still present in spite of this tool being part of our toolbox. And then we'll go into next steps. I do want to point out that we have an appendix included in the briefing, and there you'll see an overview of the commercial NEZ program, which is spearheaded by our Office of Economic Development. So certainly if there's any comments about that, we're able to answer that as well. All right, next slide. So the Neighborhood Empowerment Zone program. The program's ultimately set up to support the construction of single-family homes, duplexes and condos, as well as the renovation of existing homes, those dilapidated homes that are in need of repair. And you'll see that we're offering specific areas around the city that should be designated as NEZs. Next slide. Each NEZ includes a part of our market value analysis stabilization area. We wanted to make sure that we are leveraging the targeted investments that are going on in those stabilization areas using this tool. The stabilization areas are defined as weaker housing markets surrounded by stronger markets. These are the ones that are sort of at the tipping point where existing homes need repair or renovation. We're seeing market values going up, and residents are at risk of displacement. The value to this program is both development fee reimbursements that can be offered on a limited basis, and we're proposing that be funded with the Housing Trust Fund, and tax abatements on the value added to the homes. Wanted to give you a brief scenario to give you a sense of just how we thought this would work, right? So at a cost of about $10,000 per house for new construction, you're looking at 75 new homes being constructed, being supported, that would serve families under 120% of the area median income. Here in Dallas, that represents a household of four that's earning about $100,000 a year. At a cost of about $2,000 per house for renovations, we're looking at serving 125 individual renovation projects. We expect that given this level of investment, that it would trigger about a 1 to 10 level of leveraging private investment for a total cost of about $2.8 million, This is both the $1 million, roughly $1 million that would be allocated from our housing trust fund and the lost tax revenue. We'd see this generating about $25 million in private investment. Okay. Next slide. Now, why would the city want to take this on? Well, we went back and looked at the a study that was done by the National Association of Home Builders. This came out in 2013. And what we saw was that those homes valued around $244,000 in the first year alone. Excuse me, the study looked at some 17,000 homes that were built. And in the first year alone, these 17,000 homes resulted in a combination of direct, indirect, and induced economic impact of $3 billion, right? And on an ongoing basis, it represents about a half of $1 billion. So clearly, this is a market that we need to be tapping into more. Next slide. As we look closer at the city of Dallas and the investment that could come from this proposal, going back to that 75 home example, the production of 75 new homes would trigger some $15 million in private in regional investment just in the first year, and an additional $3 million annually. Right. And these are on relatively small dollars. Right. Next slide. So what are we trying to address with the NEZ? Going back again, we have areas around the city where we're concerned about displacement. There are strong real estate market pressures, and over the years there's been historic disinvestment. So we our objective with this tool is to help those homeowners stay in their homes as long as they choose to, at a rate that they can afford. In addition, we realize that of the supply of affordable homes that are being built serving those 120% AMI households and below, we're just not taking advantage of enough of that. Not enough of that product is coming to Dallas. So we're looking to this tool to support us in serving that segment of the market. Next slide. I said before that the NEZs are include our stabilization areas. These areas have market pressures. Again, these are the areas where there has been unmet maintenance needs, code compliance issues, nearby vacant lots. So what we see in this tool is a way to address those things. In the housing department, you may be very familiar with our home repair program, our home buyer assistance program, but those aren't enough. Right, and those may serve a certain segment of the population. So this tool is intended to help serve some of those other areas that our current tools don't let us reach. Okay. Next slide. So, if you look at new homes valued under $300,000, we know that $300,000 represents the average home value in Dallas. $300,000 also represents the high end of what we would consider affordable housing in Dallas. And what we see is that while Dallas represents about 20% of the region's population, we're only receiving about 2% of the new homeowners coming to Dallas. Right. Prior to the 2008 recession, we were at a peak of 2,178 homes priced under $300,000. By third quarter 2019, that number was down to 412. Right. So I just want to sort of highlight that. There's some 17,366 homes being built under 300,000 across DFW, and less than 2% are being built here in Dallas. All right. And so this tool is targeted to help us address that number. Next slide. We went on Zillow and looked at the housing stock that was available, particularly those homes that were built between 2015 and 2019 that were valued under 300,000. And what you see is that most of these communities, there's dozens of communities, which represents hundreds of homes, most of these communities and homes are somewhere other than the city of Dallas, right? They're in our neighboring suburban cities, which are all listed here. Through that search, as you look at all homes, only 123 of those were built in Dallas. The next slide is intended to show you through a map just where those homes are located and how many of them are in Dallas. Next slide. So oftentimes when we talk about affordable housing, we run into residents who think an affordable house is a house valued under $100,000. And what we see is that between 2010 and 2019, that supply has dropped significantly. All right. 2010, we were at some 87,000 homes. By 2019, we're down to about 48,000. And if you look at the next bracket of house prices, between 100 and 200,000, we were at 69,000 in 2010. That's dropped. You don't start to see an increase in numbers until you get to the 200,000 and up number. So that's concerning to us, particularly being in the business of affordable housing. We want to see these numbers grow, and we want to utilize the tools that are available to us to help these numbers grow. Next slide. So the comprehensive housing policy that council adopted in 2018, it identified three main goals: increasing the supply of affordable housing, promoting fair housing choices, and overcoming patterns of segregation. These are the reasons why we're here today with this recommendation. One of the things that we've done more recently since the housing policy has been adopted is to break the policy into focus areas. These are the five focus areas that are reflected in the housing policy. We've got our new development, our affordability preservation, our homeless housing initiative, our neighborhood investments that are being made, particularly on infrastructure and amenities, and the funding and other supportive actions that we can take to support these goals. Right. Next slide. So when we look deeper into the comprehensive housing policy, again, we had these reinvestment strategy areas that were identified, the target areas where we're targeting for investment. I've been talking about stabilization areas, but there are other target areas. Those are the redevelopment areas and the emerging markets. The stabilization areas, again, represent the weaker markets surrounded by stronger markets that are at risk, where we see residents at risk of displacement. Again, the NES is focused on new development, new affordable housing, and the rehab of existing housing. I want to tell you a little bit about some of the outreach that we've done since we took this on, took on the idea of bringing this forward to you. We've now briefed our Housing Policy Task Force Steering Committee three times: September, October, and December. We maintain a list of more than 400 members who subscribe to our Housing Policy Task Force listserv, and we've reached out to them, informing them about the NES. And then we held a in-person meeting with more than 50 of those members who came out to share their input on how they thought this could benefit them and where there might have been room for improvement to the program. Through the input that we've gathered, the research that we've done, we've accepted most of what's been shared with us, with one exception, that being a waiver of Title 10 for tree Article 10 for tree mitigation fees. We didn't think it was appropriate for the city to be getting behind waiving that fee, given how important that is to us. But besides that, for the most part, we received some positive feedback and incorporated the new ideas as best we could. So in summary, this slide is intended to sort of give you a snapshot of what it is this program could achieve, what these benefits would look like. So we have the development fee reimbursements, which would go up to about $15,000 per home. It could go up to an additional five, depending on the need, whether that need is present or not. From a tax abatement perspective, you're looking at values that can range from anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000. And we explore this further in our appendix if you're interested in reviewing that. Next slide. Again, this slide sort of focuses in on who and what properties we're targeting with this tool. Single family, duplexes, and condos, whether it be new construction or renovation. Those are the entities that could benefit from this. For most of this, it's intended to serve households up to 120% AMI, particularly owner-occupied households. But for rental, we're recommending that it be capped at 80% AMI. Next slide. Some of the program requirements that we would include in this program if it becomes available. Number one, any home buyer participating in this would need to go through the home buyer education. We would make sure that there is no discrimination against housing voucher holders. There would be existing tenants couldn't be evicted for at least a year, except without cause. And applicants could continue to utilize our home repair and home buyer assistance programs in conjunction with this program. Right. This last bullet on here, I do want to point out, needs to be revised, because if you as a homeowner participate in the program, you wouldn't be able to receive a second round. Right? We would have helped you come to Dallas to purchase your home, to fix up your home that first time. Your neighbors, if they hadn't participated, could certainly benefit from this, but you would be able to take a second bite at that apple. Right. Over the next several slides, what you're going to see are the seven target areas where these where the NESs are proposed to benefit. These are the stabilization areas where we have that land. I'll just sort of read them off briefly. We have the LBJ Skillman area. We have a number of homes here in need of repair that could benefit from this tool. Next one. We've got the Cosview area. Again, number of homes in that area that could benefit from this tool. There's the Vickery Midtown area, where we've got condos and some single-family homes that could benefit from this tool, as well as areas in need of, homes in need of repair. Our Forest District, similar case, but here we have a lot more vacant land that could benefit from this tool, where we could spark new development. the bottom 10th Street areas, number of homes in need of repair, and a number of vacant lots that could be redeveloped with the assistance of this tool. Next one. West Dallas, another one, similar scenario there. And then lastly is Redbird North, another area. It's a redevelopment area, homes in need of repair, and a number of vacant lots. Okay. Next slide. So from a management and evaluation perspective, the Housing Department, Department of Housing and Neighborhood Revitalization would oversee this program if it comes into fruition. We have a new software that our technology department has helped us bring online, and we're looking at standing up a new module to manage this program. We would evaluate applications on an annual basis. We would review the development agreements, restrictive covenants, and the tax abatements that are requested through each application. And we would report back to the council and through our committee on how this program is performing. Next slide. From a legal perspective, I wanted to clarify what allows us to take these actions with the NES. It comes out of Chapter 378. What you see here are the various options that a municipality can use to leverage a neighborhood empowerment zone. What we're looking to do just represents a portion of these options. Next slide. Chapter 378 also allows us to waive or adopt development fees. And through the Housing Trust Fund, we're recommending that we jumpstart this program by using some of those funds. All right. Next slide. Chapter 380 is what allows us to offer development fee reimbursements. Again, an extension of what this program is designed to do. Next slide. Challenges. So, again, I've talked about all these great and wonderful things that neighborhood empowerment zones can offer and all the reasons why we should add them to our comprehensive housing policy. But we realize that it, too, has its limitations. It's not going to solve all of our problems. So I don't want you to get that impression. However, it's a critical piece, and we'll continue to work on those aspects that the NESs don't address, be it additional efficiencies that we want to achieve through the development review process, be it some of the small lot zoning program that we're researching through our 2020 work plan. Right, so. Again, critical tool to the toolbox, but it's not the silver bullet for affordable housing development. Okay. Lastly, so this item is scheduled to come before full council for consideration on January 22nd, and at that time, staff will also bring forward a second contract to add a module for our neighborly software to manage this program. And staff will continue to hold informational sessions on how this works as we work towards a rollout, assuming this is approved. So with that, I will stop there and see if the council has any questions.
Okay. Let's. Chairman Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. First, I want to thank you, Devine and Pam, for coming and sitting down and talking with me.
about this. I wanted to make sure I had a good understanding of neighborhood empowerment zones, and then, of course, as representative for my district, making sure that this is something that I figure could be beneficial to my district. Through our conversations, we looked at boundaries. We extended one boundary, considered extending it a little bit further, and we're open to that if it's necessary. Colleagues, I probably haven't said this to you, but I said it at the housing meeting yesterday. My primary concern as relates to housing is the potential for gentrification / displacement in neighborhoods where we have upper middle income individuals who live there 20, 30, 40 years. And as these in the tipping point, I'm glad that we have something in place as a warning tool to let us know when a neighborhood is on the verge of tipping toward displacement, gentrification, things of that nature. And so I see this as a tool to be helpful with that. I'm glad that we have a NES in my district. That area is one that in the next 3 to 5 years, Councilmember Atkins, that I believe is going to be one of the most thriving areas in the city because of the retail that's coming. Other individuals are going to want to be able to move there. We want more young families to be able to move, raise their kids, their DSD. The schools in that area are all performing well. And so we want to make sure that we have an opportunity to create a place where people can not be concerned about losing their home, not be concerned about if someone buys them out, what that home is going to turn into. And so I'm in support of this 100% and look forward to voting on this on next Wednesday. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Deputy Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So first, I just want to say thank you for, as Councilmember Thomas said, working with us on the boundaries. I think the first shot at this was off, but when we talk about people that lived in certain areas for a while, we're not in Hamilton Park. We're talking about 60 years, and we are at tipping point in some regards. And so I hope this is the tool that will help folks stay in their homes. I mean, that's the goal of this. And so I think we did good on the area. The boundaries look good. My main question is, how are we going to make sure this works? In other words, how do we make sure? I mean, we talked about community outreach, and we're going to have some meetings and that kind of stuff, but what else can I tell my community to say? Who do you go to? How do we help shepherd folks through this process so they take advantage of this tool?
Yes. So assuming this passes, we will roll out through our community meetings the process: who you need to call, how you submit an application, what the timing on that is. So we'll still need to develop that rollout process, but we'll make sure that attending your community meetings, holding our own community meetings, working through the Housing Policy Task Force, that process is clear.
Okay, because we just definitely need that connection. And I do want to ask, because I know that during some of the budget discussions that we looked at staffing and this kind of thing, in this same area I also have an opportunity zone. And are we still moving forward with the funding from Rockefeller and this kind of thing? Is all that still happening?
Let me answer that, Council. We have discussed and been working with Rockefeller. It was determined by them that we would look to outsource the process. I believe they're working with LISC now, who will locate here in the city to operate that and take it out of cities. The city processes, I think our processes were a little lengthy and slow for them in trying to get that started. So they're looking to fast track that through a third party entity.
So that money is no longer coming to the city?
It's not coming directly to the city, but we'll be here in the city and we'll be working and coordinating. But,
I mean, the reason I'm asking is several positions were tied to that funding from the budget as it relates to even how we're going to have resources to get information about empowerment zones and this kind of stuff out. And so what's happening with those positions? Are they not going to...
So I'll defer to Michael, but I thought there was only one position tied to and it was solely funded through the grant itself. And so,
I'm happy to talk about that a little further. As city manager mentioned, we are working to to partner with an organization essentially to host that position that we talked about earlier, the Chief Opportunity Zone Officer. And this organization would host that officer and would receive the cash amount of that grant to fund that particular officer. The rest of the grant, actually most of the grant, is services, and those will still be available and are available to us now. We're using them now directly. So those are services tied to organizations like LISC and BT Central, I think it's called, that help us identify some of the Opportunity Zone Fund managers and stay involved in some of the programming.
So my concern here is really just on the community engagement piece, and it said the two-year, this is from an article on our, it said the two-year grant will provide City of Dallas with funding for a Chief Operating Zone Officer, two community engagement specialists, and technical assistance from the Opportunity Zone. So that is, that's not accurate, or that is not impacted in this?
That was accurate at the time, but during the course of working with the Rockefeller Foundation and their experience with other cities, including ours, they have found that it's better to work through a third party. And so that's how we're going to do that. The two other positions that you mentioned, Cities of Service is one of those service providers, and they will continue to fund those particular positions as well.
Okay, and so, and Rockefeller has affirmatively agreed that they are still giving the money through this third party?
Yes.
Okay. And then, okay, I just want to make sure we're going to plug the right people in with the people in these neighborhoods that can take advantage of this tool. And to that end, I'm very thankful for being to this phase and continue to move forward on this. So thank you for your work on that. Thank you, Mayor.
Chairman Atkins.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Magoo, to address that issue with the foundation, Rockefeller Foundation. With my same question, I was going to ask also, just to piggyback on that question, is number one, was that funding part of our budget, the $1 million for the City of Dallas to operate that program? That funding would never work budget in the employee that was put in place.
Yeah, we did not include that in the budget, the city budget.
Okay. The neighborhood and power zone, you know, I'm on 100% for it. You know, I do have some concern. I look at back in 2007, we did not have Eber Holiday Elementary School, Wilma Hutch Elementary School, Kenny Carey, Kathy Gillen. Those schools was not there in District 7. In the 2010 census, we outgrew the city 2-1 in population. And I look at this, and everything in District 8, we got 58 square miles, and none of those areas was in this neighborhood power zone. And I understand the reason why, and it's kind of when we wrote the policy, the housing policy, we were trying to get more housing, more rooftop built in the southern part of town. And because of the decab, that the land value is not growing as fast, but that's not what my residents see. They see the property value is increasing faster, but the decal is not showing the fair market of land value. So when I spoke to you, DeVee, and I'm still kind of puzzled that if the land value is not increasing in District 8, and because of infrastructure, because of sidewalk, how are we going to increase the property tax and the value of District 8? Plus, Howland Hills and over there is probably over 6 years old. We got some neighborhood over 70 years old or 80 years old. And with this neighborhood and power zone, you're saying you cannot have one there.
Correct. So when you look at what this tool is used for, right, and I actually should have Pam describe it in terms of the value of the NES.
So part of the value of this tool is a development fee reimbursement for new construction. The other part of it is a tax abatement, both for new construction and also for homeowner repairs. And the issue is that if the property values, if DCAD's not picking up an increase in property values, there's the abatement isn't worth very much. So, for example, if a house goes from $50,000 to $55,000, an abatement on that extra $5,000 just isn't very much of an incentive to invest in that house, and it's not much of a benefit to that homeowner because there's not much that they're saving through that. And so our recommendation is to look a little more holistically at the number of tools that we have and to work with economic development to continue with some infrastructure work out there to increase the quality of life out there with infrastructure, with sidewalks like you had been talking about with us, and to see if we can find some tools that actually work that end up benefiting the homeowners in those areas. And we'll continue to look at property growth in those areas because that's something that's important to us.
Yeah. The other thing I'll say is that we have targeted the University Hills area of District 8 as well as the Redbird area, and we're making significant investments in those areas, both from an infrastructure perspective as well as from an economic development perspective. But you're right, it's 58 square miles. We're going to have to look at in increasing those investments, particularly as we consider the next bond measure. How much do we want to invest in infrastructure in District 8? How much do we want to build out some of those areas that don't currently have adequate infrastructure to support new housing development? And it's the hardest message for me to share with you. On one hand, you see miles and miles of vacant land that should be developed, but the housing developments aren't coming at the pace that we as a city would like to see. What's holding them back? Well, a big part of what's holding them back is that substantial investment in infrastructure.
Well, by saying that, you're telling me that we have to wait till the bond package come another 5 years from now. You're saying that we don't have adequate infrastructure, we don't have adequate sidewalks, so therefore, in the meantime, we do what?
We chip away at it. We work with the funding that it has been allocated. We look at any and every opportunity with every project to continue chipping away at it using the resources that have been allocated to us.
Well, you know, my concern is, number one, we talk about the Inland Port, we talk about UNT, we talk about all of these businesses, all the money that we invest into that part of town, and we don't have housing. We need to refurnish our housing market. We need to do that. In the meantime, we don't have a tool in the toolbox to do that at this time. But with this project right here, and that's my concern. That's why I asked that question. And if we're going to grow the tax base, you know, south of I-30, we still say we're 15% of the property tax here. We got millions and millions of dollars invested in infrastructure, but then, too, we don't have a housing stock. We don't have jobs in the Inland Port around Redbird Mall. The people are not going to live there. They're going to live in the suburb. And so all of a sudden, we get the corporate people to come there, but the money is not going to be in dollars. They're going to be in the suburb. So that is my biggest concern, that we're not doing a great enough job for the citizen in Southern part of Dallas. And that's by policy. And when we did this, due to policy, at the Housing Policy Task Force, I mentioned this way back then. And now we come today, and the same problem, we have not addressed it. Because it should have been addressed, that we need infrastructure, we need sidewalks in Southern part of Dallas. It still has not been addressed. Well, I don't think the city manager will put a task for it, but because you heard David and you heard Michael, you was not here, but this was addressed in the housing policy. In the task force, it was addressed. Shame on you and shame on the committee, shame on staff, y'all did not address it today. You were just not getting addressed. Sidewalk and infrastructure, it needed in southern part of town, in District 8, in order to have development. And we don't have two, we don't have finance to order to get it done now.
Mr. Atkins, if I may, I do want to recognize that we do have tools that can be used, and we have used them, and probably need to look at using them more in this part of town. But these are the place-based tools. These are the TIF, essentially, tools and such that extract or capture funds for that particular purpose. And many cities use those and have been using those types of tools for a long time, and including this city. We have 19 TIFs currently.
I'm not talking about a TIF. I'm talking about land value. Resident in disarray, they probably get 3 or 4 notices to buy their property. I know the value is going up. DCAD right now said the value is not going up. But you go and try to buy a property in Southern Dallas, it's higher. Some are done double. So there's a missing link somewhere that we're missing. Right. I just want to put on record.
Yes, and we'll continue to look at property values, look at other measures besides DCAD, look at recent sales to get a better sense of what that increased value looks like.
Is that it, Chairman Atkins? Okay, Chairman West.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Kudos to housing staff for another good presentation. You know, when I met with staff, we had decided this would be an item that should skip committee and come to full council because, one, it's complex, and two, it is important to the entire city in addressing displacement and beefing up our affordable housing stock. Slides 10 and 11 really illustrate it well, the shocking problem that we have with over 17,000 new homes being built across DFW under 350,000. And in the last, since 2015, only 123 that the city of Dallas has built under that number. That's just shocking to me. And I'm glad that we're pushing this issue forward as part of the comprehensive housing policy. A couple of questions. What other uses do we have for the housing trust fund that we can expect? Because this is going to compete with that, I assume, right? So what other uses should we expect to come out of that fund, and when will we get a briefing on that?
Yeah, so we're working closely with Office of Economic Development, looking at other projects, other activities that it can be used for, and we will be coming to you actively looking at new ways to utilize it.
You mentioned on Article 10 that there was a difference in the tree mitigation requirements in Article 10 between what the task force recommended and what the city's recommending here. And I worked on Article 10, so it's near and dear to my heart, and protecting trees, you know, our tree canopy. But I also hear the competing argument, which is that some of these projects can't get done, especially in the south where there's so many trees. So, how did you balance that decision when you sort of are going against what the task force is recommending here?
The thing that we were concerned about was that it's a tree mitigation fee. In other words, if you cut down a tree, you have to either replace that tree or you have to pay to mitigate for that tree being cut down. And this would have put the city in an awkward position of reimbursing a developer for cutting down a tree. Now, that being said, we have a lot of trees in Southern Dallas, and we don't want this to be a barrier for development in Southern Dallas. And so we've had some long conversations with our arborist, with the folks that have crafted the Article 10. They are working quickly on creating additional outreach, additional methodology, and additional knowledge base for developers to understand a little better what the costs are and what the opportunities are that they have in order to reduce that mitigation fee. Because if it's an old field, in other words, the trees just happen to grow up there because of neglect, that's a special category. As you know, you worked on this deeply. And so making sure that we get that word out, that folks actually work with our arborists to see what the real cost is, not the first blush cost is, of the tree mitigation to ensure that we can drop that cost down a little bit.
So it's probably something we'll come back and look at after a year of implementation and see, you know, is it working, is it not working, and hear from folks on whether it needs to be tweaked, I assume, right?
So my concern was that if Article 10 isn't quite what it needs to be, then that needs to be addressed as an Article 10 issue, not a NEZ issue.
Agreed. Slide 18, you talk about first responder and teachers qualifying as eligible households, which I think is super exciting. A lot of us have talked about that publicly in the past. And, I mean, if they fall under these requirements, then it doesn't matter what they do. Anybody can qualify. So I'm assuming you're saying there's a special category here that is that maybe their income would not be even considered. They would just automatically qualify. Is that where
we're
at? We
had a quick conversation with the attorney this morning about that, and so we need to refine that a little bit. There probably will be an income category because this NEZ is set up for housing affordability, and so there's an income rationale for that. And so we're talking with the city attorney about what our freedom is for that. We want to certainly support our first responders and our educators in the city of Dallas.
I know when you and I first met, and thank you for your briefing to me on this, we had talked about how maybe that would be something you'd want to have individual conversations with council members on, their feelings on whether you want to not set an income limit for you know, because who wouldn't want a lieutenant or whatever living, you know, in this neighborhood. So I would encourage you just if we haven't reached out to all the council members to talk about that, do that, because I would like to talk about that a little bit more before this program's finalized. And then now, Mr. Mayor, Deputy Mayor Pro Tem Magoo asked about the rollout process. It's still a little bit unclear to me and how you guys answer that. How many folks from the housing staff will be dedicated to this program? What's the number?
So I don't have staff broken out by program. Our staff are generalists, and they move based on the program. So definitely based on in the initial startup, it'll probably be one or two people who are charged with rolling out our application process. Depending on the level of interest and what it takes to manage that, we'll make some adjustments within the department to roll it out. But I can't give you that just yet.
Well, that worries me a little bit that it's just sort of like, you know, some staff here and there, and I know they have a lot of other duties, so I think that needs to be ironed out a little bit more. And then I'd also like a clear timeline on when this is going to be rolled out, not just we're going to have some community meetings, and then we're going to do the next step. Like, I'd like to know by July 1st, we're going to be accepting applications, like the date we're going to be accepting applications. Can you get that to us?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
You're welcome. Chairwoman Arnold.
Thank you. Quickly, once again, City Manager, thank you for your selection of your these work staff members that we continue to push for excellency. On the housing projects, if you could speak to us in a report on projects that are in these districts, 12, 9, 14, 13, and 10. I want to see where we are with affordable housing in those districts. And number two, I need to know, are we still impacted by the court order that encourages more of development in these areas? Are you aware of that? Because
no.
When I came in 2015, there was a problem with building more, of course, in these in the southern sector, and so we were directed to encourage development in these districts. So are we there?
I know it expired. I can't tell you exactly when it expired.
Is an attorney here right quick that can address that? Well, if not, would you get that to me so we can move forward? I need to know where we are legally, because what my people don't understand is that while we cannot build in the southern sector, because we really are being held hostage about these districts here. Also, I want to put before you council members, you know, I've been talking to some of you about committing to the campaign that Mr. Council Member from District 8 speaks to, which is that of equity. And City Manager, I'm going to ask that we develop a policy or we have a conversation so that we can push for the most expedient and legal way of channeling affordable housing and infrastructure in our districts. What we see around the horseshoe, when we go out into these community meetings that you're going to have, we heard this in the past, and I can put it forward now, we hear from some of these communities that I mentioned, don't build them over here. We don't want them over here. You know, we had one man, I think he was in your district, Mr. District 10, who said, put that over in Cedar Crest. That's what they said. And so what they're telling us is they don't want it. And so while we're going back and forth fighting to get some motion in these districts, we are still suffering in the southern sector. So we have to call it like it is. We have got to. Yeah, he said it. The man said, you know, when y'all talked about housing, that facility out there. No, we're not going to get into argument about it, but I'm just telling you.
Okay.
Housing. It's just about housing, even if it's homeless people or whatever, it comes to housing. So this is what we hear. So we're still getting the resistance. So give me the data so we can push for equity. Because you're right, when I also asked about housing, even in the southern sector, as Chairman Atkins is saying, we don't have the infrastructure. So we've got to have a plan that speaks to putting in housing, putting in infrastructure. But we don't want to continue to deal with not in my backyard. And in the meantime, we're getting nothing. And also, Mayor, thank you. I'm glad that former Councilwoman Diane Ragsdale is in the audience. I don't know if we recognize her, but thank you for your struggle. But that's what we deal with in the city of Dallas. Thank you. So if you get that report from me, then we can have a robust conversation, city manager, about reality and equity in Dallas.
Chairman Thomas, you've already spoken for a first round on this topic, have you? So I'm going to go to Mr. Resendez.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm curious to know what the difference between the way the residential neighborhood empowerment zones were created versus the commercial zones.
Right. Yep. Okay. I'm going to ask Mr. Pogue to come up and talk about the commercial side, if that he would. And by the way, there are tables and maps of the commercial zones, 1 through 9 in the back.
Yeah, I saw that.
Good afternoon. In regards to the 10 commercial NEZs, they were created for the first 1 through 8 were created spot NEZs for various commercial projects or industrial projects to stimulate economic development. And NEZs 9 through 10 were created for area-wide basis to foster economic development. So NEZ 9 is roughly by the airport area, covers roughly the proposed Salvation Army sites. And so one of the ways we looked at it to promote economic development is to look at a tool to create business retention and also foster expansion. I will say that tool is very successful right now. We have a number of applications we're looking at to help promote the area.
And
that's number 10, which is in your area, along Buckner Boulevard, which created to support small businesses. So we took some capital from your bond allocation from the previous council member, about $1 million to be set aside to promote small business development along Buckner Corridor.
Right. Thank you for that. So part of the reasoning is for economic development, right, with the commercial neighborhood empowerment zones.
That is correct.
And part of the reasoning for the residential neighborhood empowerment zones is also economic development, right?
Yes, from a housing perspective.
Okay. So my question, I think y'all know where I'm going, right? If we have a commercial neighborhood empowerment zone in Southeast Dallas, I'm curious why there isn't a residential neighborhood empowerment zone in Southeast Dallas.
So we started out using the stabilization areas that were adopted as part of the comprehensive housing policy. On one hand, you could look at placing a stabilization area everywhere, right? But it given the fact that we are forfeiting property tax revenues to create them, we try to use them very strategically. So what I would expect to have happen is we'll start with those stabilization areas that were identified and move them as needed based on how the developers respond, what level of interest we spark with them, right? So we're not there yet. It doesn't mean that we can't get there, but
do you think a residential neighborhood empowerment zone would be beneficial to Southeast Dallas?
I think in any.
I just want to add that where it helps the most is where there is a great threat of displacement. Going back to maybe the first or second slide there, where there are market pressures that we can identify through some of the analysis that shows that property values are going up and it's becoming more expensive to live there, and at a faster pace than incomes and such, and those are the tools that we use to identify those particular areas.
Right, I understand. I mean, from what I see, there's two reasonings. I'm focusing on the economic development aspect of it. And I was curious to know what your response would be, David.
So I don't think we're there yet in some parts of Southeast Dallas. I think we need to monitor it closely, watch those property values rise, and look at what neighborhoods are being impacted. And if the need be, if we see a case that we need to address, I would come back before this body and ask for some adjustment.
Okay. And the reason I'm just harping on is because the only developers that have reached out to me about building homes in Southeast Dallas are interested in using LIHTC funds. And, you know, I have strong reservations about that at this time. So if we can increase or add a tool that could benefit Southeast Dallas in one way or another, I'd be open-minded about it. And we can talk offline if you want, but I just wanted to get that point across.
Thank you.
And one other thing, one other question I had is on slide 19, how does the no evictions for 1 year, how does that work? I mean, I know no evictions for a year, but I'm just curious, as someone who invested resources, how does that work?
So each of these will have a development agreement that's required, so the person who's actually doing the work on the house and owns the house would then need to agree to the requirements within that development agreement. And if they defaulted on those requirements, we would go through our normal default process. So we'll build into our processes oversight and communication with the city to ensure that the requirements within the development agreement are actually ensured.
Okay, that's all I have. Thank you.
Chairman Narvaez, you haven't spoken yet.
I have not yet. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So on here, we spoke yesterday, David, and I just want to make sure I put it on the record that I had asked for on, you know, besides teachers and law enforcement, which I think are two excellent categories, we need to look at the medical industry simply because we have one of the greatest medical districts in the country, and we need those nurses and surgical techs and ER folks and, you know, to make sure that they have the ability to live inside of the city of Dallas. There are a lot of those folks that would qualify based on those numbers. We're not talking about the doctors and the surgeons and all of them. We're talking about these entry-level staff and these folks that have higher educations that are helping take care of our folks that are going to be moving up. And so there's a huge, especially by West Dallas, I just know from my own experience that since I live with a medical professional, that, you know, where we live, tons of the residents inside of our building actually work in the medical district. And some of them just aren't making enough money to where they could purchase a home even though they're ready to or want to. So I think that's something that we could look into. My next question has to do with environmental upgrades. I know that we have a green plan when we're building, and there's a certain criteria you have to achieve. But my question yesterday, and I know you're going to be looking into it, but I just wanted to put it on the record, was is there any way to incentivize or give a different incentive to somebody who decides to go up and above and beyond what just our basic standard is? What could we look into to doing that so that in the 10 or 12 or 15 years when it's time that they actually get an even better benefit than whatever the standard is? And then my last one, this is the one where I have concern. I was thinking of this program differently when I first heard about it, and then yesterday it was told to me that the abatement is 10 years, you know, and we freeze their tax, which I don't have an issue with. In my brain, we were going to just reduce the dollars, and then, you know, that way they get an automatic savings inside their pocket today. But it's a different route, and I think there's a legal reason that we have to do that, which is fine. You know, I think that, yeah, I just was thinking differently. But then my biggest concern is what happens on year 11? So you get your taxes frozen for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, and then all of a sudden on 11, which was explained to me, boom, you jump up to the 10-year later. So in year 11, you jump up to what the tax rate – or not the tax rate, but what the tax valuation of the property is at that point. So for some of these folks – all in my brain, all I was thinking was like, ooh, balloon payment. You know, like, we're going to get ours. We're just saving some time. So then all of a sudden it's like, well, what happens with the displacement in 10 years from now, 11 years, however long, whenever this person applied for this abatement. So my brain overnight was thinking, well, is there a way that instead of doing the abatement all up front or the frozen portion, is there a way to maybe give them an incremental savings so that in year 11, because these are people that are on fixed incomes or lower incomes, that they're not hit with this aggressive new tax bill in year 11. Now, I do know that if the program's still in existence, they would be able to reapply by reinvesting in their home, you know, again, which would then they'd be able to apply for another 10 years, but it's still at the higher 11, you know, year tax rate 11 years later. So that's my concern is I just don't want to take people because I love the program. I'm with it. I get it all. It's just that's my biggest fear is what happens to that person because it said on there a household, you know, of four can make up to $99,000 a year, which isn't going to – it's not going to qualify a whole bunch of people. But what happens to that family of four when in 11 years maybe their income is still – they still qualify – but all of a sudden now they have a different burden on them when it comes to the taxes. So I know you don't have answers for those yet. You were going to look at them. I just wanted to put it on the record as some of the things that I wanted to make sure I brought up that I spoke to you all about. But overall, I love where we're going with this. This is something I've been talking about since I got on council 2 years ago. So I love seeing that it's coming to fruition. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Chairman Thomas, for your second.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just have one question. Page 31. I forgot to mention this earlier. Okay. Under challenges, state law limits tax abatements. Is this something that has been included in our legislative agenda, or is this something that we should include in our legislative agenda? Anybody who wants to answer?
So I think it's something that we're going to have to explore further, right? Clearly, foregoing property taxes on a city that funds all of its operations through property taxes is a big commitment, right? And I think I'm not prepared to make a recommendation now that yes, that we change this because I realize the value that we as a city would be foregoing if you extended this even longer. But I think it is something that we need to look at. All right.
Well, keeping in mind, you know, we do have some time, but I would suggest that you do take a look at it and make that decision prior to us beginning to develop our legislative agenda for the next legislative session. Thank you.
Chairwoman Arnold, second round.
Yes, sir. Thank
or
you.
Or third. I can't remember.
Okay,
second.
That's fine. I'll take second. On the vouchers, would you get me clear on vouchers, that language about vouchers? You mentioned that if you were going to do what you could to protect vouchers.
So we have now some standard language that says you can't discriminate on the basis of source of income, and so that'll be written into each of the agreements as well because it's part of the program. So, for example, those landlords that have a single family or duplex rental, they would not be allowed under this program to renovate that house and then discriminate against voucher holders for that home.
All right. So I'm just trying to visualize this. So if we had a house that was, we were trying to go north with it and they were repairing or it was unrepaired. If someone came with a voucher, you're saying that they would not be able to turn them away?
Exactly, under the same standard language that we've used in our other programs that requires that they not discriminate on the basis of source of income.
So I'm just trying to figure out when they try to go north, what will happen. So just clarification for me. So I think that was the main thing I wanted to get to as we try to push this, but I wanted to make sure we had that. So thank you, Mayor.
No problem. Is there anyone else who wants to ask any questions of the panel? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for being here. Let me ask you, is Madam Secretary, City Secretary around? Do we have any? Here we go. If we have public speakers, let's go ahead and.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Those.
We do have one remaining registered speaker who's present, Fran Gaconye. You may come forward. Ms. Gaconye, you'll be given 3 minutes to speak.
Thank you.
Please address your comments to Mayor Johnson only.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor. If you would, I am visually impaired, and lighting in here is definitely an issue for me, so I will be prompt, but a little grace would be appreciated. My name is Fran Gossinier, 211 South Rosemont. Yesterday, I attended the city's Equity Indicator Symposium, where I heard Mr. Brodnack say that it is his job to deal with the problems we just drive by. He went on to say that for him, time is pressing. It is for me as well. I'm a victim of the city's inattention to the escalating animal issues and the lack of meaningful city services that resulted in the city's historic and ongoing dangerous loose dog crisis. My front yard was the ground zero for addressing animal issues and what was to become the rebuilding of DAS and its mission. This is not just my personal narrative, but the story shared by many other Dallas residents as well. Shared stories to include Antoinette Brown's. Today, new leadership at DAS has worked hard to receive no-kill milestones while balancing historic intake. This should be celebrated. But as we get farther away from the defining moments of this crisis-level safety issue, let us not forget why Ed Jamison was asked to come to Dallas. An Army veteran and mother was mauled to death by a pack of repeat offender, loose-owned, incompliant dogs. The Dallas Observer urged the city to, and I quote, send a signal to put up a flag marking Brown's grave and say, this is where the job begins and ends. Our shelter draws national attention for their improvements and milestones, yet maulings continue in public spaces. It begs the question, what are we missing? The answer is clear. We must look to the BCG roadmap and put immediate attention to the overlook recommendations so that residents young and old can walk in public parks without fear of being mauled, and so that children can walk to school safely and our companion animals will not suffer inhumanely from the inattentive and compliant owners' actions. To achieve this baseline of safety, we must follow the unanimously approved BCG plan, a plan that was outlined as an all-or-nothing proposition. To conveniently skip or discount any pillar of the BCG report would be to continue the city's historic pattern of conscious neglect, inequity, and a discriminatory behavior towards the southern sector's safety and quality of life. The last council and mayor earned the distinction of being the first and only city leaders to have a citizen mauled to death on their watch. To avoid a similar stain on your records, the council should take immediate action. A meaningful animal culture change requires you steel your backs as new ordinances and enforcement mechanisms are tested. It requires spending political capital. I urge you to continue to support the work to create stronger enforceable companion animal laws, to support holding irresponsible pet owners and rescues accountable for their actions, to support a spay and neuter culture across our city, and most importantly, to invest your political capital in implementing the education pillar of the BCG report. I look forward to meeting with each of you to discuss next steps. Please look for an follow-up email with additional information. I thank you for your time and your service to our city, and I look forward to working together to create safer, more resilient communities. Time is pressing. The surge money is running out. Thank you.
Thank you. Sandra Crenshaw has canceled. Willie Mae Coleman, not present. B.M. Randolph, not present. No, there are no other speakers, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. It's 12:27 p.m. on January 15, 2020. The council briefing agenda meeting will now go into closed session under Section 551.071 of the Texas Open Meetings Act to receive advice from and consult with the city attorney on the following matter described on today's agenda. Yvette Will Rap for Weed Gabalze et al. Versus City of Dallas, cause number 3:18-CV-76-N. With that, we will reconvene here at 1 o'clock. Thank you. Council briefing agenda meeting has completed its closed session under Section 551.071 of the Texas Open Meetings Act. And at 1:02 p.m. on January 15, 2020, we've returned to open session. Time is now 1:02 p.m., and this meeting of Dallas City Council is adjourned.